realize this is properly the Schulerite sphere of responsibility, Father Pater?" Adamson said. "And if it seemed I cherished any doubts about the zeal with which you discharge those responsibilities, that wasn't my intent." He frowned thoughtfully. "I suppose it's just the sudden appearance of so many innovations in such a short span of time which causes me some disquiet. And it would appear they're doing even worse than that for certain other people, now that word of them's gotten back to the temple," he thought.
"Strike two!"
The crowd's groans were louder as the ball smacked into the catcher's mitt. Not that anyone particularly blamed Smolth at this time. The Dragon's pitcher knew what even a bloop single could do to the scoreboard, and he wasn't pitching Smolth the way he normally would have pitched to someone with Smolth's regular season batting performance. That nasty, late-breaking slider would have tied almost any hitter up in knots. "I can certainly understand why you might be feeling some concern, Your Eminence," Wilson said, smiling and shaking his head wryly as he watched Smolth step out of the batter's box to reorganize his thoughts. Then the Schulerite turned back to face Adamson squarely. "As a matter of fact," he said rather more seriously, "I was quite taken aback by them myself, even here in Caris. While I've seen no evidence of demonic intervention during my years here, I must confess that the energy with which Carisians seek better ways to do things is often quite daunting, and this royal college of theirs only makes it worse. I've had my own moments of doubt about them, and to have so many new ideas surfacing at once was something of a shock. Having said that, however, it seems apparent that all the innovations we've been considering over the past few months are actually no more than the application of already existing approved techniques and practices in novel ways. Every one of those techniques and practices, in turn, was thoroughly tested by Mother Church before it received the Order's approval in the first place. And the writ contains no injunctions against using approved practices for new ends, so long as those ends don't threaten God's plan."
"I see."
Adamson considered the younger man for several seconds and wished he could ask the question he really wanted to ask. With most other intendants, he probably could have, but Wilson had been shuffled off to Caris for a reason. For several of them, actually, including his obvious disapproval of the way in which Mother Church's senior prelates, even in his own order, allowed pragmatism to color the decision-making process. His equally obvious disapproval of what he considered the decadence of the lifestyle embraced by those same senior prelates was just as pronounced, and his birth had made the possible consequences of his attitude potentially ominous. The Wilson family had provided no less than 6 grand vicars. The last had been only 2 grand vicarates before, and one of them, Grand Vicar Everhard the Just, had been a fervent reformer of temple abuses 100 years earlier. His grand vicarate had lasted less than 2 years before he'd somehow mysteriously fallen from his balcony to his death, but it was still remembered with shudders of horror in the senior ranks of the episcopate. As St. Everhard's direct heir, in more than one way, young Pater might easily have become a major power in the temple, if he'd chosen to play the game. And that would have posed an intolerable threat to too many cozy temple relationships. Fortunately, he was about as disinterested in politics as he could possibly have been, and those same family connections had preserved him from the worst consequences of his superior's disapproval. On the other hand, given his family, his present rank as a mere upper priest could well be construed as punishment for his tendency to make waves, as could his posting to Caris, for that matter. But no man living could question Father Pater Wilson's piety or intellectual prowess. Indeed, that was part of Adamson's problem. Wilson was far too fiercely focused on his order's duty to protect the church's orthodoxy to waste time on things like the temple's internal factions or the strife between them, and no one in his entire order was better informed on what that duty included. That might have as much to do with his assignment to Carus as any desire to get him out of Zion, but all those factors together combined to preclude any possibility of Adamson's discussing with him the potential consequences of so many Carisian innovations on the political calculations of the temple. Or the follow-on consequences for the career of one Bishop Executor Gerald.
"Would you say," the bishop asked instead, "that Dr. Macklin's new numerals and this abacus device of his fall into that same category?"
"Which category, Your Eminence?" Wilson looked puzzled, and Adamson managed not to sigh. "The category of resting upon approved practices, Father," he said patiently.
"Forgive me, Your Eminence," the Schulerite replied, "but the question really doesn't arise. While I readily admit I'm less well-versed in mathematics than many, it's obvious from my study of Dr. Markland's work that it's going to be hugely beneficial. The merchants who are already adopting these new numerals of his have clearly demonstrated that much. Of course, as the writ teaches, the mere fact that something appears to be beneficial in a worldly sense doesn't necessarily make it acceptable in the eyes of God. That was how Shan Wei tempted her original followers into evil and damnation, after all. But the prescriptions say nothing, one way or the other, about ways to count or to record numbers. I assure you, after our previous conversations, I spent quite some time with my concordances searching for any reference in the writ or the insights. I found none. The prescriptions are concerned with unclean knowledge, the sort of which opens doors to the kinds of temptation which lead men into Shan Wei's web. The Archangel Zhuo Zheng is very specific on that point, as are the insights. But the temptation lies in impiously seeking to profane that knowledge and power which are reserved for God and his angels. Within the sphere of knowledge appropriate to mortal men, the mere fact that a way of doing established tasks is more efficient and works better scarcely threatens men's souls with damnation, so long, at least, as none of the prescription's thresholds are crossed." "I see," Adamson repeated, although he was well aware that Wilson's views were not universally shared, even in the Order of Schuler. On the other hand, there was something about Wilson's voice, or perhaps it was his eyes. The young intendant's replies came quickly and easily, with the confidence of one who had, indeed, spent many hours reflecting upon them. But there was also an edge of challenge. Not defiance, and not disrespect. Never that. Yet Adamson had the sinking sensation that the young man had made his decision in the full understanding that it was not the one his archbishop, or possibly even the council itself, wanted. The bishop executor watched Smolth take a step back into the box and resume his batting stance, waiting while the pitcher and catcher tried to get together on what they wanted to do next. Although, Adamson thought, the decision shouldn't have been that complex. With two outs already and a count of two strikes and no balls, Smolth had to be feeling defensive, and the Dragons had three free pitches with which to work. Everyone in the stadium had to know it was time for something unhittable, well out of the strike zone, that they might possibly entice him into chasing for the strikeout. Apparently, the man on the pitcher's mound was the only person in Telesburg who didn't realize that, the bishop observed sardonically. He watched the pitcher shake off sign after sign from the catcher, then glanced back at Wilson.
"Then I suppose that's all that needs to be said, Father," he said.
May I assume your own report on these matters will be completed within the next day or two? I have a dispatch vessel about ready to depart for Clannir. If your report will be available, I can hold her in port long enough to include it with my own correspondence to Archbishop Erraeg. I can have it for you by tomorrow afternoon, Your Eminence. Excellent, Father. I look forward to reading it myself, and
crack!
The sudden sharp sound of wood meeting leather stunned the crowd into an instant of silence. The dragon's pitcher had finally made his pitch selection, and it was a nasty one. In fact, the ball had been almost in the dirt and at least 10 inches off the plate. But somehow the Kraken's pitcher had actually made contact, and not just contact. His lunging swing looked impossibly awkward, yet it lifted the ball out of the infield, just out of reach of the leaping second baseman, and put it on the center field grass. It landed with a wicked spin, then seemed to hit something which imparted a nasty hop that sent it bounding past the diving center fielder. It shot by him no more than a foot beyond his desperately stabbing glove, and with the bases loaded and 2 strikes, the runners had been off the instant Smolf made contact. The crowd's disbelieving roar of delight was ear-stunning, and even Gerald came to his feet as the ball rolled almost all the way to the center field wall before the Dragon's right fielder managed to chase it down and scoop it up. The first Kraken had already crossed the plate by the time he got his throw off, and he threw it over the cut-off man's head. Given the distance it had to cover and how quickly he managed to get it off, it wasn't that bad a throw, but it wasn't a good one either. It pulled the catcher a quarter of the way up the first baseline, well off the home plate, and he fumbled the catch slightly as the second Kraken crossed home with the tying run. The Dragon's pitcher had charged in to cover the plate, but he'd started late, as if he couldn't believe Smolf had actually hit the ball. He arrived just after the second runner, but he was still in the process of turning towards the catcher, who was still juggling the ball and trying to set himself for a throw, when the third Kraken came thundering down the third baseline all the way from first. The catcher finally got his throw off. A bullet, perfectly delivered to the plate. But the pitcher wasn't even looking in the runner's direction when the Kraken charged straight into him, knocked him over, and touched home base with the go-ahead run. The ball squirted away from the bowled-over pitcher, and Smolf, running harder than he ever had in his life before, found himself on third base, panting for breath, while the stadium went crazy. "Well," Adamson said with a chuckle several minutes later, as the tumult died and he resumed his own seat, "it seems miracles do happen, don't they, Father?" "Of course they do, Your Eminence." Wilson's tone pulled Adamson's eyes to his face. The youthful priest seemed startled by the levity of the bishop's observation. No, Adamson thought, not startled. Disapproving, perhaps, although that wasn't exactly the right word either. Maybe the one he wanted was disappointed. "Whatever, I need to remember it," Adamson told himself. "He's not here just to get him out from underfoot in the temple, and he's not interested in administrative compromises. I hope that doesn't turn into a problem." "Yes, they do, Father," the bishop executor agreed, his own voice and expression more serious. "Indeed they do." Jaspar Maison sat several hundred seats away from Bishop Gerald and Father Pater. Like many individuals and firms which did business in Telesburg, the small shipping house which he ostensibly owned held season tickets to the Kraken's games. His seat wasn't as good as those in the royal box or the church box, but it was almost directly behind third, and he shook his head in disbelief as Smolf wound up on that base.
"That's going to hurt,"
James Mokfrizan observed cheerfully from the seat beside him, and Maison glowered at him.
"It's only the seventh inning," he growled, and Mokfrizan chuckled.
"Of course it is," he said soothingly, and rubbed his thumb and index finger together. Maison managed to retain a suitably defiant expression, but he was afraid Mokfrizan was right. The Dragons' devastating offensive lineup had made them the odds-on favorite to take the series this year. Even the Telesburg bet-takers had agreed on that one, however disgruntled they might have been by the notion. But Mokfrizan had argued, and been willing to bet, that the Kraken's pitching, which had been very strong down the stretch, would carry the home team to victory. Maison had covered that bet at 2-1 odds, and he was beginning to suspect that in this respect, at least, his new subordinate's judgment had been better than his own. And it was like Mokfrizan to have backed his judgment to the tune of several Carisian marks, despite the relatively brief time he'd been there. He'd arrived in Telesburg as Oscar Mulvane's replacement less than a month ago, but he'd gotten a quick grasp of much more than the way Kingdom's baseball teams matched up. It was already obvious he was at least as capable as his predecessor. He was also self-confident and even more industrious and undoubtedly ambitious as well. Best of all, he was clearly not on Baron Wave Thunder's list of suspected foreign agents. All of those, except possibly the ambition, were good things from Maison's perspective. Unfortunately, Mokfrizan was still in the very early stages of assembling his own intelligence sources. Maison had considered putting his new subordinate into contact with some of the senior members of Mulvane's old web as a way to speed the process, but he'd rejected the temptation firmly. It seemed unlikely Wave Thunder had managed to identify many of Mulvane's agents, despite the Baron's obvious suspicion of Mulvane himself, since not one of them had been arrested. It was also possible, however, that Wave Thunder knew exactly who'd been working for Mulvane and had left them unmolested in hopes that Mulvane's replacement would identify himself by contacting them. But given the fact that Narman of Emerald's web of spies had been totally gutted, as far as Maison could tell, Maison's own organization had become the only window Prince Hector and his allies had in Caris. Under those circumstances, he'd decided it was far better to take a little longer getting Mokfrizan fully up to speed than to risk walking into a Wave Thunder trap and losing that window as well. Not to mention risking the one and only skin of a certain Jasper Maison. He watched as the celebration of backslapping and mutual congratulation died down in the Kraken's dugout. The next batter, Raphael Fracal, the Kraken's leadoff man, eventually advanced to the plate, while the Dragon's catcher trotted out to the mound to confer with the pitcher. Probably more in an effort to settle the pitcher down again than for any serious discussion of strategy. The Dragons had studied the scouting reports on the Krakens intensively, and they knew Furkal's power was almost exclusively to left field. The infielders were already shifting around to the left. Indeed, the second baseman had become almost a second shortstop, and the first baseman had moved halfway to second, while the catcher was still talking soothingly to his pitcher.
"I wish there'd been someone around to settle me down over the past few months," Maison thought moodily. It had been maddening to realize all sorts of things were clearly happening under the surface at the very moment when prudence and future survival had required him to operate so cautiously. He'd done his best, but his own sources had been much more strongly developed among the merchants operating in Telesburg. Until Oscar was forced to run for it, he hadn't truly realized how much he'd relied upon Mulvane's judgment and fieldwork where political and military matters were concerned.
The good news was that Prince Hector's dispatches made it clear the prince understood the constraints under which his Carizian spymaster had been forced to operate. Or he says he does, at least, Maison couldn't quite help reflecting. He'd wondered more than once, especially given Machverzahn's obvious capability, if Hector might have sent the new man in with the intention of eventually elevating him to the top position in Karras. It was a distinct possibility, and if it happened, Maison's recall to Coruscant would not bode well for his own career, although, at least, Hector was far less likely than Narmon to simply have one of his agents eliminated. For the moment, Maison had decided to take his prince's assurances of his continued confidence at face value and concentrate on finding out whatever it was Harald and Wave Thunder were working so diligently to conceal. The pitcher delivered his first pitch, and Furkal swung hard and missed.
"Strike one,"
the umpire announced, and Furkal shook his head in obvious self-disgust. He stepped out of the box for a moment, clearly settling himself back down, then stepped back into it without even glancing at the Kraken's third base coach for any fresh signs. He settled himself, and the pitcher came set and delivered his second pitch. At which point, Furkal astounded every single person in the stadium by dropping an almost perfect drag bunt onto the first baseline. It wasn't quite a suicide squeeze, but it was a high-risk move, even for someone with Furkal's speed. Despite that, its very audacity took the defense completely by surprise. The fact that he'd swung away at the first pitch probably helped, but it was obviously a pre-planned ploy, despite the lack of any sign from the third base coach, because Smolth had broken for home at the exact same instant Furkal squared around to bunt. The infield shift left the pitcher responsible for covering first, but he was left-handed, and his natural motion carried him towards the third base side of the mound. It took him one critical instant to recover, charge over, and scoop up the ball. He was too late to tag Furkal out, and by the time he whirled to throw home, Smolth had gotten just enough of a head start to beat the throw and score while the capacity crowd shouted, whistled, and stamped its feet in approval. There was an analogy here, Maison decided. He was only too well aware that he still didn't know everything the Carizians were up to. Most of what he did know was more disquieting than threatening. Unless Maison missed his bet, the new rigging design Sir Dustin Oliver had come up with, this schooner rig of his, represented the most direct challenge anyone knew anything about. Maison rather doubted all of the fantastic tales about its efficiency and advantages could be accurate, but it was obvious those advantages were still substantial. They were bringing Oliver dozens of orders for new ships, the first of which were already coming out of the yards to swell the ranks of the huge Carizian merchant marine. A merchant marine which was already far too big and had entirely too many advantages. On the other hand, the secret of how it worked could scarcely be maintained for long, not if it was going to be used where anyone else could see it anyway. And the same thing was true of Roger Machlin's new way of counting. Indeed, Maison had already personally acquired one of Machlin's abacuses and dispatched it to Coruscant. He and Machverzahn were also following up the rumors of still more innovations among Karras's textile producers, and he expected to be able to deliver a preliminary report on them as well within the next few 5 days. A part of him was tempted to decide all of that meant he was getting back on top of the situation, but somewhere deep inside, a small, nagging voice warned that he wasn't. That what he knew about, what the rest of the world had been allowed to see, was only a part. a deliberate screen thrown up in an effort to convince everyone else to concentrate on the clearly visible part of the iceberg. The same way Furcal's first swing had distracted everyone from the possibility of a bunt. And I wonder, Mason thought, if all these fathers of innovation are really responsible for their own work. It was a question he'd pondered more than once. All the evidence suggested that Machlin, Oliver, and Rayan McHale truly had come up with their spate of new ideas all on their own. The fact that Harald's college had brought them all together, where their ideas could strike sparks off one another, really could explain how so many new concepts had flowered in such a short period of time. But Mason couldn't quite shake the suspicion that Merlin Athrawes' abrupt arrival in Telesburg had had more than a little to do with it, too, and that was what made him so nervous. "Don't borrow trouble, Jaspar," he told himself firmly. "Even if there's any truth to the story that the man really is a Saiyajin, it doesn't make him some sort of all-around superhuman. If he was truly behind all of this, they'd have done something better with him than making him a lieutenant in the Royal Guard, for Langhorne's sake. Instead of worrying about him, why don't you worry about what the rest of the world hasn't been allowed to see yet? If they're so willing to tell us about the things we do know about, just what might they be hiding behind the things they've made public knowledge?" He didn't know the answers to those questions, but he did know Wave Thunder and High Admiral Lock Island had strengthened the already tight security they maintained at Helen and Sandshoal Islands. Since Calvin Armok's death, security at Hyrotha had also been stepped up significantly. All of that could be readily enough explained as a routine precaution after the attempt to assassinate Caleb, and the discovery that someone as highly placed as the Duke of Tirion had been in league with the kingdom's enemies. But it also just happened to provide a screen behind which almost anything might have been going on. And Jaspar Mason didn't like that. No, he didn't like that at all. April, Year of God 891. 1. Off the Truman Bank, South Howell Bay.
"Signal from the flagship, sir!"
The Earl of Grey Harbor turned from his place at the quarterdeck rail as the shout floated down from the senior of the two midshipmen perched in the mizzentop. He folded his hands behind him, adjusting to the easy movement of the deck with the remembered reflexes of 20+ years at sea, and watched HMS Typhoon's captain look up at the teenaged midshipman who'd announced the signal. That young man had his eyes glued to the flagship. The noises of a ship at sea, wind humming through the rigging, the rhythmic surge of water past the hull, the creak of timbers and masts, the high-pitched cries and whistles of seabirds and wyverns following in Typhoon's wake, flowed around Grey Harbor while he watched the senior middy straining to read off the signal flags streaming from HMS Gale's mizzen yard. The other youngster sat with his back against the mast, holding the outsized book in his lap firmly against the insistent wind while he waited to turn its pages.
"Well, Master Margenty?"
Captain Stewart prompted, glowering up at the mizzen top as the seconds trickled past.
"I can't quite make out the hoist, sir, and—"
Midshipman Margenty began, then broke off.
"I've got it now, sir. Numbers 9 and 37. Form line of battle on the port tack, sir."
"Very good, Master Margenty,"
Captain Darrell Stewart said, and looked at yet another midshipman, this one standing expectantly on the quarterdeck with him.
"Hoist the acknowledgement, Master Ames," the captain said. "Lively now."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
Midshipman Ames responded, and began barking orders to the seamen of his detail. Grey Harbor watched without any temptation to smile,
despite the fact that Ames' 13-year-old voice had yet to break and that the youngest of the seamen under his command had to be twice his own age. The Earl had once stood in Ames's shoes, and the youngster clearly knew what he was about. Balls of brightly colored bunting spilled out of the flag bags, and four of them were bent on to the signal halyards in the proper sequence. Ames watched carefully, making certain of that, then gave a final order, and the flags rose swiftly. The topmost flag reached the yardarm, and a quick jerk broke them to the wind. They streamed out, duplicating the signal at Gale's yardarm, simultaneously indicating receipt of the flagship's signal and repeating it to show it had been properly read. Magenty had never taken his eyes off the flagship. A few more moments passed, and then, as Gale's signal officer hauled down the original hoist, he shouted down to the quarterdeck once again.
"Execute, sir!"
"Very well, Master Albert," the captain said to his first officer. "Lay the ship on the port tack, if you please."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
Lieutenant Albert replied, and lifted his leather speaking trumpet to his lips.
"Hands to sheets and braces," he barked.
Grey Harbor watched Stewart's well-drilled crew as petty officers bellowed and seamen scampered to their stations. The evolution was more complicated than it had been aboard Grey Harbor's own final command, but Typhoon was a galleon, not a galley. At 120 feet, she was 30 feet shorter than a typical galley, and she was also both beamier and taller, which made her look undeniably stubby. And she had 3 masts, compared to a typical galley's single one, of course, but some additional changes had been made as well. The most immediately apparent change, and the one which Grey Harbor had discovered, had actually most offended his view of the way ships were supposed to look, was the disappearance of the towering forecastle and aftercastle. Those castles had provided the advantage of height, both for defense against boarders and for pouring fire from the matchlocks, crossbows, and light cannon down onto the decks of an opponent. Their disappearance seemed wrong somehow, which he knew was a foolish attitude. They were no longer needed, and he'd already noticed how much more weatherly Typhoon had become without their wind resistance helping to push her to leeward. Besides, their removal had been an important part of Merlin's and Oliver's efforts to reduce top weight and displacement. But however he might feel about the way the castles had been cut down to the upper deck level, the alterations in her sail plan were actually a far more profound change. Her square-rigged spritsail had been replaced with 3 of Sir Dustin Oliver's new jibs, triangular staysails set fore and aft on the forward-leading stays supporting the foremast, and the mizzenmast's lateen sail had been replaced by a spanker, a gaff-rigged fore-and-aft sail with its foot spread by a heavy boom. They looked decidedly odd to Grey Harbor's eye, but he had no intention of complaining. Nothing was likely to change the fact that square-rigged vessels always had been, and would remain, clumsy and awkward to maneuver. The improvement the new headsails and spanker made possible, however, had to be seen to be believed. It wasn't enough to match the nimbleness and weatherliness of the schooners Oliver was producing, of course, but Typhoon's jibs and spanker still gave her a huge maneuver advantage over more conventionally rigged ships. They were located well forward and aft of Typhoon's natural pivot point, which gave them far more leverage than their sail area alone might suggest, and they helped her sail far closer to the wind than any square rigger had ever before managed. That meant she had a shorter distance to go across the eye of the wind when it came time to tack, and the headsails and spanker's leverage imparted a powerful turning moment as she began her turn as well. The combination brought the vessel through the maneuver much more quickly and reliably.
It was still easy for an unwary skipper to be caught aback and end up in irons, head-on to the wind and drifting to leeward, but it had become less easy, and the new sail plan helped a vessel regain way much more quickly if it did happen. Personally, Grey Harbor knew he would always be a galley captain at heart, but he was far too experienced not to grasp the enormous changes Lock Island, Seamount, and Merlin had wrought. Typhoon completed her maneuver, settling onto her new heading, and Grey Harbor stepped back to his position at the rail, admiring the precision with which Commodore Stainair maneuvered his squadron's vessels. In addition to all his other innovations, Merlin had radically overhauled the Navy's signal procedures as well. The Royal Carisian Navy had evolved its own set of signals over the years, but they'd been restricted to fairly simple, straightforward messages. Hoisting a single red flag to the masthead, for example, as an order to engage the enemy. Adding the golden kraken on black of the Carisian ensign above it to order attack on the enemy's van, or below it to order an attack on his rear. Hoisting a black and yellow striped flag below the national flag as an order to form line astern of me, or above it as an order to form line abreast. There simply hadn't been a way to transmit more complicated orders, until Merlin stepped in, that was. Baron Seamount had been too deeply involved in producing the new, modified artillery to deal with the signals issue himself, so he delegated that particular responsibility to Sir Dominic Stainair. Stainair, the younger brother of Bishop Michael Stainair, had been handpicked by High Admiral Lock Island to command Seamount's experimental squadron. He'd been chosen in part because his superior's faith in his loyalty and ability to protect the Navy's secrets was absolute. But he'd also been chosen because of his raw ability. At 37, with over 25 years of seagoing experience, Stainair was young enough to remain flexible, yet more than experienced enough to help the Seijin construct a comprehensive vocabulary of just under 800 standard commands. Those commands were listed in the signal book clasped so firmly by Midshipman Magenti's assistant in the top, and each of them had been assigned a numerical value. Using the new signal flags, based on Merlin's Arabic numerals, each of those commands, which dealt with the overwhelming majority of possible evolutions, could be transmitted using a simple hoist of no more than 3 flags. The simple inclusion of a plain black flag, already called the stopper by the signal's parties, between numerical flags served as punctuation. By inserting it to indicate breaks between individual values, multiple commands, such as Stainair's order to form line, followed by the order to do so on the port tack, could be hoisted simultaneously. Stainair's vocabulary also contained 1,000 of the words most commonly needed by seamen, each also represented by a single numerical hoist to permit more complicated signals to be exchanged. And if it should happen that a required word wasn't in the vocabulary, the letters of the alphabet had also been assigned flag values. Any word could be spelled out, although that was a laborious, time-consuming process. The result was a vast increase in tactical flexibility, before battle was joined at least. The amount of gun smoke even old-style naval battles produced was quite sufficient to reduce the utility of any visual signaling system to virtually nothing once the actual shooting began. But any professional sea officer knew the ability to send quick, positive orders to the units of a squadron during the approach to battle was still a priceless advantage. "Excuse me, my lord." Grey Harbor looked up, shaking himself out of his reverie, as a diffident young officer appeared beside him.
"Yes, Lieutenant?"
"Captain Stewart's respects, my lord, but we're coming up on the target."
"Ah, of course. Thank you, Lieutenant, and please thank the captain for me as well."
"Of course, my lord."
The lieutenant touched his left shoulder with his right fist in salute, then returned to his duties, while Grey Harbor carefully inserted the cotton seamount had provided into his ears.
"Beat to quarters, Master Albert!"
Stewart's voice sounded muffled through the cotton, but the order was clear enough, and the traditional deep-voiced drums began to boom. Once again, bare feet pattered over wooden decks as the crew scurried to their stations. It wasn't necessary, actually, to clear for action, Stewart had seen to that long since, but the galleon's decks offered a seething flood of humanity in what seemed like utter chaos. Grey Harbor's experienced eye saw through the apparent chaos to the intense, disciplined order underneath it. Where a landsman would have seen only confusion, he saw the precise choreography of a formal ball, and the fact that so much of what Typhoon's crew was doing was completely new only made that precision even more impressive.
"Load starboard, Master Albert," Stewart said.
"Starboard batteries, run in and load!"
Lieutenant Albert shouted, and Grey Harbor stepped closer to the quarter-deck rail to gaze down and watch the gun-deck crews casting off the breaching ropes which secured the newfangled gun carriages to the ship's side. Men tailed onto the side tackles, grunting with effort as they heaved, and their massive charges moved backward in a thunderous squeal of wooden gun trucks across deck planks which had been sanded to improve the gun crew's traction. The guns on Typhoon's main deck were Krakens, which had been reboard by Edward Hausman. They weighed 2.5 tons each, and they moved heavily, reluctantly, despite their carriage's wheels.
"Avast heaving!"
Gun Captain shouted, announcing their satisfaction as their ponderous charges moved far enough inboard. The number 3 from each gun crew removed the wooden tampion which normally sealed the bore against spray, and the number 2 removed the sheet-lead apron which protected the secured gun's vent so number 1 could attach the gunlock. Powder monkeys, boys, some of them as young as 7 or 8, dashed up to each gun with their wooden cartridge buckets. Each bucket contained a single flannel bag filled with gunpowder and then stitched shut, and each monkey dumped his cartridge on deck at his assigned gun, then went racing back for another. The gun's number 5 picked up the cartridge and passed it to number 3, who slid it down the muzzle of the gun. Number 6 had already selected a round shot from the garland along the bulwark. He passed it to number 3, while number 4 rammed the powder charge home. The gleaming round shot, just under 6.5 inches in diameter and weighing over 38 pounds, went down the bore next, followed by a fat, round wad of rope yarn to keep it from rolling around inside the gun as the ship moved, and number 4 tamped everything down with another stroke of his rammer. Gun trucks squealed again as the cannon were run back into firing position. They snouted out their gun ports all down the galleon's starboard side as Typhoon bared her claws, and the number 8 and number 9 of each crew slid stout wooden handspikes under the gun tube. The gun carriage had been designed with steps cut out of the brackets, the heavy side timbers which supported the main weight of the gun, and the crewmen used those steps as purchase points, grunting with effort as they levered the breech of the gun upward. The trunnions were placed so that the gun was slightly breech-heavy, and as the handspikes heaved the breech to the desired elevation, the gun captain inserted the elevation wedge, a simple wooden shim designed to fit under the breech and hold it there. More work with hand spikes levered the guns around, training them as far forward as possible, and then the gun captains drove priming irons, small iron skewers, down the gun's touch holes, piercing the cartridges, and reached for the primer boxes each wore at his belt. That, too, was a new innovation. Before Merlin's intervention, each gun had been primed with loose powder from the gun captain's powder horn, and, when the moment came, it had been touched off with a red-hot iron rod or a length of slow match.
But burning matches and glowing irons had never been the safest things to have around loose gunpowder, especially on a narrow, pitching deck filled with moving men, so still more changes had been made. Now the gun captains took goose quills packed with fine-grained gunpowder from the cases at their waists and inserted them into the vents. They stripped away the wax-covered paper seals to expose the powder filling, and metal clicked as their number twos cocked the gunlocks. The firing mechanism was an adaptation of Merlin's flintlock, which was essentially identical to the lock used on the new muskets, but without a priming pan. Instead, when the striker came forward, the flint struck a milled steel surface and showered sparks over the powder-charged quill. The entire evolution of running in, loading, and running back out took less than 2 minutes. Intellectually, Gray Harbor had already known it could be done that quickly with the new guns and carriages, but actually seeing it drove home the enormity of the changes about to transform naval warfare. Bringing a Kraken into action on an old-style wheelless carriage without cartridges and with powderhorn priming would have taken at least 4 times that long. The Earl stepped across to the bulwark, careful to keep well clear of the recoil paths of the lighter carronades which Seamount had cast specifically for the quarterdecks and foredecks of ships like Typhoon. They threw the same weight of shot as the reboard Krakens, but they weighed less than half as much, they were less than half as long, and they required only half the crew. They also used a much lighter charge and were shorter ranged, although the care Seamount had taken in boring them out meant they, like the refurbished Krakens, had substantially smaller windages than any previous artillery piece and were correspondingly more accurate across the range they did have. Gray Harbor looked forward. The old galley Prince Willem and 3 equally old, worn-out merchantmen had been anchored at 200-yard intervals in the relatively shallow water just off the Truman Bank. The extensive sandbank lay far enough off the normal shipping routes to allow the Navy to train unobserved, and the water shoaled enough in its vicinity to make it practical to anchor the target vessels. Now Commodore Stainer's flagship led the other 4 ships of his squadron in line ahead towards his target under topsails, jibs, and spankers alone. Compared to Gray Harbor's old galley command, Typhoon seemed to crawl under so little sail, and, in fact, despite the breeze, she was making good no more than 2 knots at best, with barely a fifth of her total canvas set. But those sails were what Merlin and Seamount had designated fighting sail, yet another change from Gray Harbor's day, when galleys had struck their yards and canvas completely below before engaging. Even at their slow, dragging pace, the ships of the meticulously dressed line were covering almost 70 yards every minute, and the waiting targets drew closer and closer. Gray Harbor was almost as impressed by the station-keeping displayed by Stainer's captains as he was by any of Merlin's innovations. In his experience, even galleys found it difficult to maintain precise formation, and sailing ships were still less prone to staying where they were supposed to be. On the other hand, by the time fleets of galleys smashed into each other for the hull-to-hull melee which resolved their battles, formation-keeping was seldom an issue any longer. That wasn't going to be the case for gun-armed galleons, and Seamount and Stainer had drilled their crews mercilessly with that in mind. There. Gale drew even with Prince Willem, and the early afternoon was filled with a sudden bellow of smoky thunder. Even at this range, 200 yards astern of the flagship, the abrupt simultaneous detonation of 18 heavy guns was like a hammer blow across the top of Gray Harbor's head. The flagship disappeared into a sudden, dense cloud of powder smoke, and Gray Harbor's eyes widened as a hurricane of shot slammed into the anchored galley. Splinters and broken bits of timber flew.
The galley shuddered visibly as the tempest of iron blasted into it, and something deep inside Grey Harbor cringed as he visualized, or tried to, what it would have been like for Prince Willem's crew had she had one aboard. He knew he'd failed. He'd seen battles enough during his own Navy days, but even the heaviest galley carried no more than 10 or 12 guns, of which no more than 4 or 5 could normally be brought to bear upon a single target. And broadside weapons were seldom much bigger than the 3-inch piece called a falcon, which threw only an 8.5-pound ball. He'd seen what single heavy cannon balls could do as they demolished hulls and smashed through the fragile bodies of human beings in hideous sprays of blood, torn tissue, and flying limbs. But he'd never seen what the next best thing to 20 of them could do in a single one of Seamount's new broadsides. Gale was 150 yards from her target. That was long range by most naval gunnery standards, although her Krakens had a theoretical maximum range of 3,000 yards. The chances of actually hitting something from a moving ship's deck at anything over a quarter mile or so were remote, to say the least, however. Indeed, most captains reserved the single salvo they were likely to have time to fire before closing for the melee until the very last moment, when they could hardly have missed if they'd tried, and might hope to sweep their opponent's decks with grapeshot and wreak carnage among the other ship's boarders. The number of guns Typhoons and her consorts carried, coupled with their rate of fire, changed that calculation, however. Even at the squadron's slow rate of advance, and even given its rate of fire, there was just time at this range for each gun in Gale's broadside to fire twice before her own movement carried her beyond the zone in which it could be trained far enough aft to bear on Prince Willem. The second broadside was a much more ragged affair, as the guns fired independently, each going off as quickly as its own crew could reload and run out again. The first broadside's billowing smoke, rolling downwind towards the anchored targets, more than half obscured the crew's line of vision as well, yet both of those broadsides smashed home with devastating effect. The actual holes the round shot punched in the galley's hull weren't all that large, but Grey Harbor knew exactly what was happening inside that hull. Splinters, some of them 4 and 5 feet in length and as much as 6 inches across at the base, were being blasted loose. They were scything across the ship like screaming demons which would have clawed down any unfortunate seaman in their paths. Other shots went home higher up the galley's side, smashing down entire sections of her stout bulwarks, sending yet more lethal clouds of splinters howling across her upper deck. Commodore Stainer had thoughtfully placed straw-stuffed mannequins here and there about the target ship's decks, and Grey Harbor saw huge clouds of straw flying in the sunlight, like a golden fog bank which would have been a ghastly red under other circumstances, as splinters and round shot tore them apart. Then Gale was past Prince Willem, ready to fire upon the first of the anchored merchant ships, while Typhoon, following in the flagship's wake, approached the battered galley.
"Stand ready, Master Albert. We'll fire by sections, I believe,"
Captain Stewart said conversationally through the rumbling crash of Gale's last few shots.
"Stand ready to fire by sections!"
Albert shouted through his speaking trumpet in turn, and Typhoon's captain stepped up beside Grey Harbor at the bulwark as the gun captains took tension on the lanyards attached to the gunlocks. Stewart gazed thoughtfully at his approaching target, shoulders relaxed, eyes intent. This might be the first time Grey Harbor had actually seen the new weapons in action, but Stewart and the other members of the experimental squadron had been drilling with them for 5 days now. The captain clearly knew what he was about, and his left hand rose slowly. He held it level with his left ear for several seconds, then brought it slashing down.
By sections! Fire as you bear!
Albert bellowed, and the forward guns thundered almost as he spoke. Gale had fired every gun which would bear in a single, massive broadside. Typhoon's guns fired in pairs, gun deck and upper deck together, as soon as the gun captains could see their target in front of their muzzles, and she mounted 19 broadside weapons to Gale's 18. It was a long, drawn-out, rumbling roll of thunder, not a single brazen bellow, and the ship's fire was even more accurate than Gale's had been. So far as Grey Harbor could tell, not a single shot missed, despite the range, and Prince Willem shuddered in agony as round shot after round shot smashed into her splintering timbers. The guns themselves lurched back, wooden trucks thundering across the planking, muzzles streaming smoke and embers. The stink of burning powder clawed at Grey Harbor's nose and lungs, and he coughed, more than half deafened, despite the cotton stuffed into his ears. The deck seemed to leap up underfoot, battering the soles of his feet, and Typhoon twitched as each pair of guns recoiled and the breaching tackle transmitted the force of 3.5 tons of recoiling bronze directly to her timbers. The thick, choking clouds of smoke turned the deck into twilight before they went rolling slowly away from the ship on the breeze. By allowing his gunners to fire independently as soon as they bore upon the target, Captain Stewart had bought them a few precious moments of extra time to reload. As in Gale's case, each gun crew was responsible for reloading and firing as rapidly as it could, and Grey Harbor watched them as they launched into yet another choreographed burst of chaos. The number 4 on each gun drove home the soaking wet sponge on one end of his rammer. It slid down the bore, hissing as it quenched any lingering embers from the previous charge. The gun captain stopped the vent, pressing his thumb, protected from the heat by a thick leather thumb stall, over the vent hole to prevent air from entering the bore and fanning any embers the sponge might have missed as a fresh cartridge was rammed home, followed by another round shot and wad. Gun trucks squealed as the gun was run back out. Hand spikes clattered as it was trained farther aft, priming quills went down vent holes, gun locks cocked, the gun captains drew the firing lanyards taut, looked to be certain every member of their crews were clear of the recoil, and yanked. The flint strikers snapped down, sparks showered over the priming quills, and the guns bellowed yet again. It was ear-stunning, a bedlam which had to be experienced to be believed, and Prince Willem's battered side began to literally cave in. Ahead of Typhoon, Gale's broadside thundered again as she took the first of the anchored merchantmen under fire. The merchant vessel was more lightly built than the galley, and the effect of the flagship's concentrated fire was even more horrific. Grey Harbor could make out few details, thanks to the obscuring gun smoke, but he saw the target's mainmast suddenly quiver, then topple slowly over the side. Even as it toppled, he heard a crashing rumble from HMS Tempest, Typhoon's next astern, as her forwardmost guns came to bear on Prince Willem, and he shook his head. "Thank God Merlin is on our side," he thought. 2. King's Harbor Citadel, Helen Island.
"I'm impressed," Earl Grey Harbor said.
He, Caleb, and Merlin stood atop the King's Harbor Citadel, looking down at the anchored ships of the experimental squadron in the basin below. Arnold Falcon and the rest of Caleb's marine bodyguards waited for them on the uppermost floor of the stone keep. It was much cooler there, for the summer sun was hot overhead, and it gave the Crown Prince and his companions privacy as they stood under a canvas awning that popped quietly in the breeze blowing over the fortress.
"Sir Alfred told you you would be, Regis,"
Caleb replied now, and Grey Harbor chuckled.
"Baron Seamount told me I would, true," he acknowledged,
and glanced at Merlin. "He also told me I shouldn't pay much attention to your efforts to give him the credit for it, Merlin." "I suppose there's some truth to that," Merlin acknowledged, turning to face the Earl fully. His relationship with Grey Harbor was very different from what it had been, and the First Counselor raised a sardonic eyebrow. "I did provide the original impetus," Merlin said in response, "and I suppose many of the underlying concepts came from me, too, but I would never have had the practical knowledge and experience to put those concepts into effect without Sir Alfred and Sir Dustin. And the work on tactical formations has been almost entirely Sir Dominic's and Sir Alfred." Which, he reflected, was truly the case. The Royal Carisian Navy had developed a sophisticated tactical doctrine for its galleys, along with standard formations and an entire conceptual framework. As Baron Seamount had noted that very first day, however, none of those formations or tactics had been built around broadside armaments. But his navy was accustomed to thinking in terms of developed doctrine, not the sort of free-for-all brawl most other navies seemed prepared to settle for, and he and Stainer had sat down and essentially reinvented the line-of-battle tactics of the late 18th and early 19th centuries before the first conversion had been completed for the experimental squadron. They'd been practicing and refining them ever since, and Merlin was frankly awed by their accomplishments. "As I say," he went on, "we really needed that experience, and Caleb's had more than a little to do with making things work, for that matter." "That much I can believe," Grey Harbor said, and smiled approvingly at his crown prince. "Caleb's always been mad about the Navy."
"Oh, no, he hasn't," Caleb said with a chuckle. "Not since you and Father sent me to sea, at any rate."
He looked at Merlin and shuddered dramatically.
"There's this unfortunate tradition here in Caris," he explained. "For some reason, people seem to feel the heir to the throne ought to know how the Navy works, so they send him off to sea as a midshipman. And," he added feelingly, "his superior officers are expressly forbidden to treat him differently from any other midshipman. I got to kiss the gunner's daughter more than once."
"Kiss the gunner's daughter, Your Highness?" Merlin repeated with raised eyebrows, and it was Grey Harbor's turn to chuckle. "The bosun's responsible for disciplining the midshipmen," he explained. "That means miscreants find themselves bent over one of the guns, while the bosun thrashes them firmly enough even a midshipman might think twice about repeating his offense."
"Oh, I always thought twice," Caleb said cheerfully. "I just went ahead and did it anyway."
"Somehow I find that depressingly easy to believe," Merlin said.
"So do I."
Grey Harbor did his best to produce a properly disapproving glower. Unfortunately, it bounced off the Crown Prince's unrepentant grin without even a scuff mark. "All the same," the Earl continued more seriously, "that unfortunate tradition exists for a reason, Your Highness, and the way you've taken hold out here shows why. I'll be honest, Caleb. When your father first assigned this to you, a part of me thought it was solely a way to get Merlin out here without raising any questions. But I was wrong. He gave you this job because he knew how well you'd do it, too." Caleb waved one hand, still enough of a boy at heart to be embarrassed by anything which sounded like praise, but Merlin shook his head. "The Earl is right, Your Highness," he said, rather more formally than he normally spoke to Caleb these days. "In fact, I've been very impressed watching you and Baron Seamount in action. I think you have a natural feel for this sort of thing." "And," Merlin thought, "you're young enough not to have too many preconceptions to overcome in the process."
"So do I," Grey Harbor agreed. "And I can understand why the two of you wanted me out here to see all this firsthand. I've read your reports to the King, and, of course, Caleb's briefed the senior members of the Council several times, but until you've actually seen it, you can't really believe it or grasp all of the implications."
Merlin nodded. Caleb had handled those briefings because even now, Grey Harbor and Wave Thunder were the only counselors who knew the truth about Merlin's contributions.
But even though Grey Harbor had been privy to the full details from the very beginning, this had still been his first chance to actually see the new hardware. The demonstration had been carefully planned to show the new artillery in action under near-perfect conditions, as the Earl understood perfectly well, but his genuine enthusiasm pleased Merlin enormously. It wasn't really a surprise. The First Counselor was a highly intelligent man who also happened to be an experienced naval commander, but that made it no less welcome. At the same time, the Earl said, turning to look back out over the squadron's anchored ships, I'm worried about how much time we have. Hector's obviously getting more and more nervous about what we're up to, and I'm afraid our time may be running out more quickly than we'd hoped. Especially, he turned his eyes back to Merlin's face, in light of the reports we're getting out of the Temple and Bishop Gerald's offices right here in Telisburg. I know, Merlin sighed. He leaned forward, bracing his folded arms on the battlements, and his sapphire eyes were distant, unfocused, as he gazed across the harbor. I'm hoping, he continued, that the Temple's agitation will settle down a bit once Father Pater's latest reports have a chance to circulate. In a reasonable world, that's probably what would happen, Grey Harbor told him. In a world where Hector and our good friend Narmon are pouring their lies into the church's ear, it probably won't. The First Counselor's expression was grim, and Caleb nodded in bitter agreement. Do you think the Council of Vicars is likely to take an official position? Merlin asked. Even with his unwillingness to risk putting bugs inside the temple proper, he had an excellent feel for what the church's hierarchy was saying, thanks to his ability to eavesdrop on the vicar's subordinates living in Zion. But he discovered that knowing what it was saying wasn't the same thing as knowing what it was thinking. Just as he'd come to realize that Grey Harbor and Harald had far more insight into the realities of Safehold's theocratic politics than he did. Probably not, Grey Harbor said after a moment, not openly at least. Their own intendant is reporting that we violated none of the prescriptions, which is only true after all. The Church can issue whatever decrees and commandments she chooses, and no one has the authority to gainsay her, but the Council's usually cautious about appearing capricious. That doesn't mean the vicars, or at least the group of four, won't do whatever they believe they have to, but traditionally they've preferred to act deliberately, after considering all of the evidence, officially at least. It was Merlin's turn to quirk an eyebrow, and Grey Harbor chuckled. The sound was both cynical and rather sad. Mother Church is supposed to be above issues of political power and greed, Merlin. Some of her clergy truly are, like Father Pater, for example, or Bishop Michael. But others, like Chancellor Trenaire and his allies in the Group of Four, aren't. I wouldn't say this before any other ears, but the truth is that the Episcopate and even the Council of Vicars is more concerned with the wielding of power than with the salvation of men's souls these days. He shook his head slowly, brown eyes distant, and Merlin sensed how much it cost him to admit his own cynicism where the keepers of his religious beliefs were concerned. Calculations are made in the temple and in the brothels and gaming houses of Zion, on the basis of political expediency and greed, as often as on the basis of doctrine or the writ, I'm afraid. More often, Caleb said harshly. Merlin looked at him, and the Crown Prince's eyes were deep and dark with bitter memory. There was a time, the Prince continued, when Mother Church truly was a mother to all of her children. That day is gone. Merlin managed to keep his expression tranquil, but this was the most frankly he'd ever heard Caleb or Grey Harbor express themselves on the subject of the church, even after the interview with Father Pater, and Caleb's bitter observation hit him like a splash of cold water. He hadn't truly realized until this moment just how fully justified the Council of Vicars' concerns over Carisian restiveness under the church's oppressive control actually were. "Caleb's right, I'm afraid, Merlin," Grey Harbor said heavily. On the other hand, he continued, probably exactly because of the way those political factors have come to influence the council's decisions, the vicars are extraordinarily careful to avoid drawing attention to them. The group of four will be very certain that any decision, any official decision, the council or the Grand Inquisitor may hand down, is carefully written. It will make the council's orthodoxy and devotion to truth crystal clear. And so long as Father Pater insists on reporting we haven't fallen into error, haven't violated the prescriptions by thought or deed, the council has no justification for moving openly against us. That, unfortunately, doesn't mean the group of four won't move against us. Never forget, Merlin, that the Temple Lands are one of Safehold's great kingdoms. The vicars aren't simply the princes of the church, they're secular princes as well. As such, they're as subject to political pressures and calculations, and ambitions, as any other ruler. Whether or not Mother Church openly condemns Caris for doctrinal error, the council may well choose to put forth its secular power against us. We have not, perhaps, he smiled faintly, appeared sufficiently pliant for the council's taste. Merlin looked at the First Counselor, and Greyharbor shrugged. "Don't misunderstand me, Merlin. The King, and Caleb and I, doubt neither the power nor the love of God, nor do we doubt the Church was created and ordained to safeguard the salvation of men. But the vicars are also men, and if those responsible for the salvation of others fall into error, into the snares of ambition, greed, and corruption— who will redeem them?
I don't know, my lord, Merlin said after a moment, his voice soft. If Caleb's bitterness had been eye-opening, the implications of the Earl's analysis were breathtaking.
Neither do I, Greyharbor said sadly. But whether or not any of us dare to admit it openly, much of the kingdom's current danger is the direct result of the church's encouragement of Hector and Narmon. Caris has grown too wealthy, too powerful for the council's taste. There are many reasons for that, but the consequence is that the group of four has quietly and quite unofficially supported Hector's ambition to reduce our power. I suspect Hector, for all his cunning, fails to grasp that having used him to humble us, the council is scarcely likely to allow him to assume our present position. Nor does that matter at the moment. What matters is that, to date, the group of four has had only to support our enemies' natural ambitions. That, without your arrival, would have been quite sufficient for the vicar's purposes in the fullness of time. But you have arrived, and I very much doubt that the council has any concept of how radically the conflict between us and Hector and his allies is about to change as a consequence. When the group of four does realize the truth, it will act. Not officially, perhaps, or not as Mother Church, at least. But there are many avenues open to it, and I feel quite confident it will find one of them. The Earl's voice was even grimmer than his expression, and Merlin turned to face him fully. "My lord," Merlin said quietly, "if this group of four chooses to act against Caris with all of the church's resources, can Caris survive?"
"I don't know," Greyharbor said softly. "I truly don't know. Before your arrival I would have said we couldn't, that no single kingdom could possibly hope to. Now I see some possibility we might, but only a possibility.
It wasn't my intention to bring Caris into direct conflict with the church," Merlin said. "Not yet, at least." He added to himself with painful honesty, "not until we'd built the kingdom up into something which might survive the confrontation."
"I never said or thought it was," Greyharbor replied. "But the truth is, Merlin, that I'd long ago accepted that the best we could hope for was to stave off disaster for a time. For my lifetime, probably. Possibly for Caleb's. But not any longer than that."
Merlin glanced at the bitter-faced Crown Prince, and Caleb nodded.
For just a moment, the Crown Prince's mask slipped, and Merlin saw through the young man's habitual cheerful humor to the ultimate despair which had hidden behind it. It seemed to be a day for revelations, he reflected, as Grey Harbor continued.
It's certainly possible the things you've done will bring the Council's suspicion and distrust of the kingdom to a head sooner, but that day would have come eventually, with or without you. The King's decision to insist upon a Caris-born priest as Bishop of Telesburg wasn't made lightly, and Bishop Michael's seen the coming storm as clearly as any of us. The only thing which has changed is that you may have made it possible for us to survive that storm, and, if you haven't, if my kingdom and my king and prince and what we believe God requires of us all go down into ruin anyway, that will still be a better fate than to live as the gelded slaves of someone like Hector, or,
the Earl looked directly into Merlin's eyes,
of a council of vicars so corrupted by its own secular power that it uses the authority of God himself for its own gain in this world.
Father agrees, Caleb said softly.
And so do I, Merlin.
The Crown Prince looked straight into Merlin's sapphire eyes.
Perhaps you're beginning to understand why Father was so ready to listen when you appeared. Don't think either of us, or Bishop Michael, have failed to notice how careful you've been never to openly criticize the Church. And don't think we haven't recognized that you recognize that, ultimately, what we believe, what we see as our responsibility to our subjects, is a threat to the Council.
There were shadows in the Prince's own eyes, and in those shadows, Merlin saw Caleb's memory of their conversation following the Kraken attack as well.
I won't, he said after a moment.
Good, Grey Harbor said, his voice as soft as Caleb's had been. But then he drew a deep breath and spoke much more briskly.
That, however, brings us back to this experimental squadron of yours. While I would never wish misfortune upon a prince of the Church, his smile, Merlin noted, was downright nasty. I must admit that the way Archbishop Erech's accident prevented him from visiting us as scheduled has provided a useful cushion. By the time he actually gets here, Father Pater's reports probably will have made it even more difficult for the Council to contemplate any official action against us, and,
he gave Merlin a piercing glance, we'll have had time to further obscure the fact that so many of our recent innovations have come from a single man.
Trust me, Merlin, Sagin or no, the Inquisition would look very closely at you if the Temple realized everything you've shown us over the past few months.
That it would, Caleb agreed.
But whatever the Council's position, Grey Harbor continued, Hector and Narmon aren't going to react well if, when, they realize just how you, Caleb, and Sir Alfred are in the process of increasing the fleet's fighting power. At the moment, Benjamin shares your confidence that they haven't tumbled to what's going on out here at King's Harbor, but they have to be aware of the other changes you and the College have been introducing.
I know, Merlin agreed.
And, he thought, Wave Thunder's right about what Hector and his buddies know, so far. The Snark's bugs make that clear enough. How long we can keep it that way, though, is another question, isn't it?
They've been careful to avoid open warfare with us this long, Regis, Caleb pointed out, and Grey Harbor nodded.
That's true, but that's been because our fleet is almost equal in numbers to Hector's and Narmon's combined, and they know our captains and crews are better than theirs. As Merlin's visions have shown, however, they're working hard to acquire new allies to increase their own naval strength. If they succeed in doing so, and especially if they should realize how things like the new cannon are going to increase our existing strength, they may well choose to strike quickly, in an effort to destroy us before we can complete our plans and preparations.
The Earl's right, Caleb, Merlin said soberly. At the moment, they believe they've got time, that our present strength is effectively the greatest we can sustain.
That means time favors them, if they can acquire those allies Regis is talking about. If they decide time's no longer on their side, though, their plans are likely to change.
Precisely, Grey Harbor nodded energetically. Which brings me back to the point I wanted to raise originally. How quickly can we complete our planned expansion?
In a lot of ways, that's really a question Sir Alfred and Master Hausman could answer better than we can, Caleb replied after glancing at Merlin.
That's true, Merlin agreed. I think we could probably make a fairly accurate guess, though.
Please do, then, Grey Harbor invited, and Merlin shrugged.
The problem is how few galleons the Navy had in commission when we began, he said. That, and the fact that your galleys carried so few heavy guns, which means we don't have that many existing weapons to work with.
Grey Harbor nodded patiently, and Merlin grimaced internally. As he told the Earl earlier, the combined experience and knowledge of Edward Hausman, Sir Alfred Hindrick, and Sir Denis Oliver had been priceless. There'd been countless difficulties inherent in taking the conceptual knowledge Merlin had been able to provide through to a practical hardware stage, which would never even have occurred to him. And because of that, unfortunately, he'd underestimated how long it was going to take to put that hardware into production in adequate numbers. Except, he reflected wryly, for the coppering technique. The one thing that's gone perfectly is also the one that's the hardest to conceal when we put it on, and the one that has the least immediate effect on our ship's firepower. Of course, his amusement faded, there's more to combat effectiveness than gunpowder alone. Still, even, or perhaps especially, coppering the hulls in adequate numbers was taking longer than he'd originally let himself allow for. Especially in light of the numbers of ships Karras's enemies could muster between them. Traditional Safeholdian navies counted their strength in galleys. Those galleys, or most of them at any rate, might no longer mount old-fashioned beaked rams, but aside from that, they would have been right at home when the Athenian navy went up against Xenophon at Salamis. Well, that was probably unfair, but they would certainly have been familiar to Don Juan of Austria at the Battle of Lepanto. They had evolved from purely coastal craft into something which at least had aspirations to a true seagoing warship, especially in the case of Karras, but they would never have survived typical Atlantic weather conditions on old Earth. Fortunately, Safehold seas tended to be smaller than those of old Earth, and the crude state of Safeholdian navigation meant that until relatively recently, even the most daring mariners had tended not to stray far from sight of the coast. One of the things which had fueled Karras's rise to maritime supremacy had been her captain's iron-nerved willingness to undertake longer voyages, like the 2,000-mile voyage across the heart of the sea known as the Anvil, steering by the stars and pure dead reckoning. Surviving such journeys had been more than the traditional coastal ship types could manage, and the galleon, like the ships of Commodore Stainer's squadron, represented a relatively new type which had evolved in response to the new challenges. Merlin found himself thinking of the galleys as Mediterranean types, and the galleons as the prototypes, crude and far from fully developed so far, of the Atlantic type. They were less maneuverable than galleys, slower in light airs, and immobile in calms, but far more survivable than any galley in heavy weather. Most of Safehold's navies felt no great pressure to adopt the galleon as a warship, however, partly out of ingrained conservatism, but also for some very practical reasons. Every major naval battle in Safehold's history had been fought in coastal waters, and naval strategy focused on control of strategic straits, passages, and seaports. Deep water survivability was scarcely a major factor for that sort of warfare, and the galley's maneuverability, ability to move even in a dead calm, and large crew made it a far more suitable platform for the boarding actions which climaxed virtually all naval engagements in the absence of truly effective artillery. But as Baron Seamount had recognized that very first day, the galley was about to become hopelessly obsolete,
regardless of where battles were fought. The unavoidable fact that a ship which depended upon long banks of oars as its primary means of movement simply could not mount the sort of broadside which could be mounted by a sail-powered ship doomed it as a type. Unfortunately, the Royal Carisian Navy had possessed only a few more galleons than anyone else, and every one of them was anchored in King's Harbor as a part of Commodore Stainair's squadron. That was bad enough, but the fact that the Navy's galleys had mounted so few cannon was almost equally bad. Stainair's ships each carried between 36 and 40 guns. The five of them mounted a total of 184, which represented the Kraken armament of almost 50 galleys. Matters weren't quite as bad as that might have seemed to suggest, given that over a third of the squadron's total artillery consisted of the newly designed and cast carronades, but he, Caleb, and Seamount had still exhausted the Navy's entire reserve stockpile of Krakens. The 80 galleys the Royal Navy kept in permanent commission could have provided the Krakens for another 7 or 8 galleons, and there were also the 50 galleys of the reserve fleet, which he and Caleb were already planning on stripping of guns. But 15 or 16 gun-armed galleons weren't going to be sufficient to take on the combined fleets of Karras's enemies. It was fortunate Karras had both copper and substantial deposits of tin. Merlin was aware that sooner or later, and probably sooner, they would have no choice but to begin using iron, especially given the voracious appetite for copper of the new anti-borer and anti-fouling sheathing. But bronze was actually a better alloy for smooth-bore artillery. It was too soft to stand up to the wear of rifled shells, but it was more elastic and much less brittle than iron, which made bronze pieces less likely to burst, with catastrophic results for everyone in the vicinity. Unfortunately, even bronze guns still had to be manufactured, and that took time. Hausmann's welded trunnions had helped enormously as far as the existing guns were concerned, and he'd used some of the saved time for his reboring project as well. That had finally produced a genuinely standardized gun caliber, and by reaming out the Kraken's often irregular bores, he'd been able to reduce windage, which had simultaneously improved accuracy and increased both muzzle velocity and shot weight. It had also allowed him to use the same shot for the long guns and the new carronades, which greatly simplified ammunition requirements. "We have to make some decisions," Merlin told Grey Harbor now. "We've pretty much exhausted the existing supply of Krakens, and we can't afford to call in the existing fleet and strip it of artillery to get more of them. Even if that wouldn't make Hector and Narman suspicious, we're going to need the existing ships to back up the new types, whatever happens. We can produce almost 3 carronades for the same amount of metal that goes into a single Kraken, and we've got large numbers of lighter artillery pieces, and quite a few heavier ones, we can melt down and recast. In fact, we're already doing that, partly because reclaiming the existing bronze lets us reserve more of the available copper for hull sheathing. But even if carronades can be cast and bored faster than long guns, it still takes at least half or two-thirds as long to produce one. And they're shorter ranged."
"Range would concern me less than many other factors, for now at least," Grey Harbor said thoughtfully. "As I understand it, these carronades are accurate out to at least 200 or 300 yards, true?"
"Close to twice that, actually," Caleb agreed.
"Well, most naval battles, most old-fashioned naval battles, are resolved at somewhat shorter ranges than that."
Grey Harbor's tone was desert dry.
"Actually, they're usually resolved at sword's length. If you can stand off to a range of 50 or 100 yards and pound them the way Stainair's squadron pounded its targets today, that should be more than sufficient."
"I tend to agree, my lord," Merlin nodded. "And there's another advantage to the carronade, the weight of the individual pieces. No one's ever designed ships to carry this weight of artillery. Despite everything Sir Dustin and I have been able to do to reduce top weight, Stainair's galleons are still overloaded by the weight of their own guns. It was Greyharbor's turn to nod soberly. If we use carronades instead of krakens, we'll cut the weight of the guns by almost two-thirds for the same broadside, Merlin continued. That, in turn, would mean not only that the new ships we're building could carry a more powerful armament, but also that we could convert more existing merchant ships. In some ways, I don't really like the thought of conversions. Merchant ships aren't built as heavily as warships. They can't take as much pounding or carry the same weight of artillery. On the other hand, if any battles we fight work out the way we hope they will, that shouldn't be a decisive factor. And the carronades weigh almost exactly the same as falcons, Caleb pointed out. If we've got time to cast enough of them, we can replace our galley's broadside weapons as well.
Good points, all of them, Greyharbor said. Still, I think the range problem is one we're going to have to address in the long term. Eventually our enemies are going to discover most of what we're up to, even if we manage to keep the surprise concealed until the first time they face the new ships in combat. When they do discover it, anyone but an utter idiot, which, unfortunately, neither Hector nor Narman is going to realize they need the same sorts of ships. And when they have them, we won't be able to choose our own ranges. That means longer guns eventually, so we'll have to find a way to solve the top-weight problem.
That's certainly true, Regis, Caleb said. Most of the squadron ships are already beginning to hog at least a little.
I'm not surprised, Greyharbor grimaced. The phenomenon known as hogging was scarcely unknown among galleys, after all. When you put heavy weights at the ends of a wooden hull, which is where most of a galley's guns happen to be mounted, it inevitably put a severe strain on a ship's keel. The usual result was that the ship's ends drooped downward, and its keel hogged, literally warped and bent upward in the middle, sometimes severely enough to threaten the ship's safety. Sir Dustin and I have been discussing that very problem with Baron Seamount, in our copious free time, of course, Merlin said dryly. I believe Sir Dustin may be on the track of a solution, but for right now, none of us want to make any changes in existing building practices unless we absolutely have to. It's more important to get the ships built than that we build the very best ships we possibly could.
I agree, Greyharbor said again, firmly. Even if it does offend my sensibilities to build so many ships out of green timber.
Caleb made a face which mirrored the Earl's unhappiness. Ships made out of unseasoned timber rotted quickly. The Safeholdian teak tree, which really did resemble the terrestrial tree of the same name, was the most favored shipbuilding timber on the planet. It was very strong, very hard, and remarkably resistant, when properly seasoned, to rot. But they weren't using teak for most of the new ships. Carus had large stands of teak, at least half of which were owned outright by the Crown and the Royal Navy. But not even teak could resist rot effectively without time to season properly, and Harald and Caleb had flatly refused to use up their precious reserves of teak on ships whose lifespans were inevitably going to be short, to say the very least. They'd be lucky if they got more than 5 years of service out of any of the vessels whose construction Oliver was currently overseeing here at King's Harbor, Merlin knew. Unfortunately, the available supply of seasoned ship timber was limited, and a ship which rotted into uselessness 5 years down the road but could be available this year was far preferable to one which wouldn't rot but couldn't be built in time, which meant they didn't have a lot of choice. Sir Dustin believes we should be able to find most of the timber we'll need for several dozen ships by breaking up the reserve galleys, Merlin offered.
We can't do that until we have enough newly built galleons, of course, but we'll begin as soon as we safely can, with your and the King's permission, my lord.
My permission you already have, Greyharbor told him. I feel confident the King will also agree.
We're still going to be hard-pressed to build the new ships, Caleb warned the First Counselor. "I'm delighted by Master Hausman's success in providing the sheet copper for the hulls, but just finding the spars to mast them is going to be a genuine problem. And you can't roll spars out in a private foundry the way you can sheet copper. When the Navy starts buying up all of the suitable timber for that, it's going to make someone like Hector start asking questions anyway."
"And spars and copper are only part of it," Merlin agreed. "We need canvas, cordage, pitch, everything you can think of."
He shook his head ruefully. On the one hand, he'd been astounded by how quickly Sir Dustin Oliver could get new ships laid down and built. The naval constructor's estimate, and it looked accurate, was that he could complete a new galleon's hull in no more than 90 days from the moment the green timbers arrived at the King's Harbor shipyard. From Merlin's research, that compared favorably with the construction times for 18th-century shipbuilders on old Earth under emergency pressure. Unfortunately, Oliver could build only about a half dozen of them at a time, and however quickly he could build the hulls, the ships, as Caleb had just pointed out, still needed to be masted and rigged, not to mention finding the guns to put aboard them and the men to crew them.
"That's another place where converting merchant ships will help," Grey Harbor pointed out. "Surely we can cut gun ports and modify existing sail plans more quickly than we can build from scratch."
"I'm sure you're right, my lord," Merlin said, "although we have to think about strengthening their hulls against the recoil forces as well. Still, I'm afraid our most optimistic estimates suggest that it's going to take us at least another full year to reach our original target numbers." Grey Harbor looked grim.
"I don't think we are going to be able to keep all of this secret that long," he said.
"I agree," Caleb said. "In fact, I think we need to reconsider laying down additional ships at Hirafa." Grey Harbor's eyes narrowed unhappily at the suggestion, and the Crown Prince shrugged.
"I'm not blind to what Merlin calls the security aspects of the idea, Regis. As soon as the Navy starts building large numbers of galleons someplace people know we're doing it, someone's going to start wondering why. I know that. But after Telesburg itself, Hirafa has our biggest shipyards. We could build a dozen in the Royal Dockyard at Hirafa alone."
"That's true, I realize, Caleb," the First Counselor said. "And once we're within striking range of our final projected numbers, finishing up the final ships in public, as it were, won't be a problem, I suppose. But still..."
He let his voice trail off, and Caleb nodded in glum agreement. But then the Crown Prince's eyes narrowed as Merlin stroked one of his waxed mustachios thoughtfully.
"What?" the Prince asked.
Merlin looked at him, and Caleb snorted.
"You're pulling on your mustache again. Are you going to tell us what new deviousness you've thought of this time or not?"
"I don't know that I'd call it devious," Merlin said mildly, "but I have just had a thought."
"Well," Grey Harbor said with a grin, "in that case, while Caleb may have spoken with the impetuosity of youth, he does have a point. Spit it out, man!"
"It just occurred to me," Merlin said, "that there's no reason we can't build additional ships right out in the open if we really want to. I think we've all been forgetting that Sir Dustin is one of the kingdom's best-known private ship designers. He's already taken orders to build at least a dozen schooners I know of in Telesburg, all for different owners. There's no reason we couldn't have him lay down another dozen or so galleons for the Navy in privately owned yards without telling anyone who he's actually building them for."
"But," Caleb began, only to stop as Grey Harbor held up one hand. "You're suggesting we announce, or rather that he and the shipyard owners announce, to everyone that he's building them as merchant vessels for private owners?"
"Exactly." Merlin shrugged. "They won't look exactly like existing galleons, even on the building ways, but they won't look all that different either. We couldn't copper them as they were built without giving away the game, but once they were launched and rigged, we could sail them to King's Harbor or Hirafa, dry dock them, and copper them there.
That would probably actually save time. And if the hulls look a little odd compared to standard merchantmen, everybody knows Sir Dustin's just introduced a brand new type with the schooner, and he's rigging two galleons he already had under construction with the new square rigger sail plan as well. Given that everyone knows he's experimenting, why shouldn't he be building galleons with hulls that don't look quite like those of existing ships? And, Caleb said, any initial temptation to object vanishing into sudden enthusiasm, the very fact that we were building them openly would actually help keep anyone from suspecting what we were up to. How likely is Hector or Naaman to expect us to be building secret weapons right out in front of everyone?
Greyharbor tapped his chin for a moment, then nodded.
I think you have a point, Merlin. Both of you have points, in fact. I'll recommend to the king that he seriously consider authorizing the suggestion. But I think I'll also suggest that we don't bring the shipyard owners into the secret unless we absolutely have to. Better, I think, to pick a handful of ship owners we know we can trust and act through them. They can place the orders for us, with the treasury to actually pay for the ships when they're completed.
If that's practical, I think it would be a very good idea, my lord. Merlin agreed.
Very well, then. Greyharbor looked back out across the anchored squadron once more, then drew a deep breath. I think it's time I was returning to Tellisburg, he said. The king and I will have quite a lot to discuss, but at least I can tell him...
He looked back at Merlin and Caleb and smiled broadly, that our efforts out here are in excellent hands.
3. Royal Palace, Erastor.
I don't much care for Hector's tone lately, Travis Olson said. The Earl of Pine Hollow sat across the dining table on the covered terrace from Prince Snarman, watching his cousin pry shellfish out of their shells with gusto. Hal Shandir had joined them, but the spymaster's appetite obviously hadn't accompanied him. He'd done little more than nibble at the salad on his plate.
I don't care for it either,
Narman grunted around a mouthful. He swallowed, then sipped fastidiously at a glass of fruit juice-laced water.
I don't care for his tone, the prince continued, setting the glass down, and I'm rapidly coming to the conclusion that I don't much care for him either.
Unfortunately, my prince, Shandir said, the feeling appears to be mutual.
Narman glowered at the baron. Shandir wasn't exactly basking in his prince's admiration at the moment. The fact that Narman knew as well as Shandir did that his current problems weren't entirely his fault didn't make the prince any happier. Unfortunately, he couldn't disagree with what Shandir had just said.
It's never been more than an alliance of convenience, he said, after a moment, reaching for another shellfish and the silver tongs. It's not exactly as if we have to love one another.
No, Pine Hollow agreed, but what bothers me is this attitude of his. Look at this, for example. He tapped one of the letters he'd brought to the working lunch.
He's not discussing things with us. He's telling us what he's already decided. It's the kind of letter I might have sent to the bailiff on one of my secondary estates.
It's not quite that bad,
Narman disagreed. His cousin snorted, and the prince shrugged.
I'm not saying you're wrong, Travis. I'm just saying Hector's always seen himself as the senior member of our little partnership. As nearly as we can tell, things aren't going a lot better for him in Tellisburg than they are for us right now, so he may be getting just a little testier as a result. It's not the insult that bothers me, Narman, or not much at least. It's the mindset behind it. If he's talking to us this way while the two of us are still allied against Karis, what's his attitude going to be after Karis goes down? And just who do you think he envisions getting the lion's share of the spoils?
I'm sure he plans on it being him, Narman said comfortably. Of course, his calculations may just prove to be slightly in error. Pine Hollow's eyes narrowed. He sat back for a moment, gazing at his cousin in intense speculation. Then he cocked his head to one side.
"Is there something going on here that I ought to know about?" he asked.
"Well,"
Narman said, opening up another shell and inspecting its contents thoughtfully.
Actually, there are two things going on. First, there's a little side conversation I've been having with Bishop Executor Willis. It seems Archbishop Liam is already sounding out support in the temple for granting us a church mandate over Margaret's land on the basis of our historic association with its people. From what the Bishop Executor says, the Archbishop's meeting with a fairly favorable reception on that point. After all, we're already on excellent terms with the new Earl of Hanth, and our orthodoxy is much firmer than Harald's, or for that matter Hector's.
He scooped out the shellfish and popped it into his mouth, managing to chew and smile sardonically at the same time. Pine Hollow frowned thoughtfully. Liam Tyrne, the Archbishop of Emerald, was greedier than most archbishops, which was saying quite a lot, actually. Of course, Tyrne hadn't drawn the most lucrative of archbishoprics, either. Emerald wasn't exactly poverty-stricken, but compared to some place like Caris, or Coruscant, for that matter, its tithes were decidedly on the penurious side. And Tyrne's holdings outside Emerald weren't precisely the most prosperous imaginable. Still, the man came from one of the more powerful of the church dynasties, and his name and family connections gave him considerably more influence than his lack of wealth might indicate. And that lack of wealth made him much more willing to use that influence in return for suitable consideration.
All right, the Earl said after a moment. I can see that. After all, presumably the church will incorporate any new territory into his archbishopric, but that still leaves Silver and Caris Island itself.
The church isn't going to let anyone snap up all of Caris, Travis, Narman replied.
The Council of Vicars is perfectly willing to let Hector and me break Caris, but the vicars aren't about to let either of us gobble up everything that's made Harald so irritating to them. Hector has visions of sneaking around them somehow, and I suppose it's possible he may get them to sign off on a mandate over Silver. For that matter, he may even manage to acquire outright title to it. But Silver's worth a lot less than Margaret's land, and the people living there are even more firmly attached to the Armachs. Controlling them's going to be a fairly strenuous pastime, one I'd just as soon avoid. As for Caris proper, I'll be very surprised if the church doesn't step in and establish either direct rule, possibly in the name of Harald's minor children, assuming either of them survive, or else install a suitable puppet of his own, possibly both. A regency for Harald's younger son might give them enough transition time to accustom Caris to direct church rule, and there'd always be plenty of opportunities for him to suffer one of those tragic childhood accidents when he was no longer necessary. Either way, neither Hector nor I is going to get possession of Telesburg. The difference between us is that I know I'm not, and I'm already making arrangements to be sure I do get the second most desirable slice of the pie.
Fair enough, Pine Hollow nodded. On the other hand, I am your first counselor, Narman.
I think it might be a good idea to keep me informed on these little side negotiations of yours, just to keep me from stepping on any toes because I didn't know they were there.
A valid point, Narman agreed. He sipped wine and squinted out across the sunlit gardens from the terrace's shade.
I'll try to bear it in mind, he promised, although Pine Hollow had no great expectation that he'd succeed.
Narman probably didn't even tell himself about all his various plots.
But you said there were two points Hector wasn't aware of, the Earl prompted after a moment, and Narman chuckled nastily. I know Hal hasn't had very much luck rebuilding his agents in Telesburg, he said, but whatever may be happening to him there, he's still doing quite well other places.
Which is one reason, the prince's voice turned somehow subtly darker, I'm being patient with him about Caris. Pine Hollow nodded. Baron Shandir's every effort to replace the departed Brady Lahang's operation in Caris had failed. Every attempt seemed to be detected almost instantly, and Shandir had lost at least a half dozen of his better people trying to figure out what was going wrong. Among the things he's done right, Narman continued more lightly, is to establish contact with Baron Stonekeep. Pine Hollow's eyes narrowed once more. Edmund Rustman, Baron Stonekeep, was not only King Gorja of Tarot's first counselor, but also his equivalent of Hal Shandir.
Stonekeep is keeping us informed about Gorja's negotiations with Hector. His services aren't coming cheaply, but when the time's ripe, we'll use him to tell Gorja what Hector really has in mind for Tarot, which is for it to get exactly nothing out of the deal, except relief from its treaties with Karis. I'm sure Gorja won't care for that at all, especially if we offer to support his claim to at least a chunk of Carisian territory of his own. We're providing Stonekeep with some of our homing wyverns as well, which may come in handy if quick political decisions have to be made.
Pine Hollow nodded again, this time in unalloyed approval, though he was tempted to point out that this was another of those little stratagems which Narman might have wanted to bring to his first counselor's attention.
And, as a measure of last resort, as it were, Narman continued, Hal has a man in place in Manchir. In fact, he has two of them. In a worst-case situation, Hector's health may turn out to be much more fragile than he assumes it is.
The prince smiled again, then nodded at one of the serving platters.
"Pass the rolls, please," he requested pleasantly.
June, Year of God, 891. 1. Tellisburg.
"So what's all this about?"
Jaspar Maison knew he sounded just a bit testy as he sat across the table from James Macfrazan, but that was perfectly all right with him. Macfrazan hadn't been due to make contact with him for another 2 days under their agreed-upon schedule. Given Oscar Mulvane's hasty departure and the fact that he and Maison had met fairly regularly and publicly, Maison had ample reason to feel decidedly unhappy at the prospect of frequent meetings with Macfrazan.
"I know we're off schedule," Macfrazan said now, "but this is important, I think."
"I hope so, anyway," Maison grumped, then shrugged.
Part of it, he knew, was that he and Macfrazan sat in the same sidewalk café, at the exact same table, in fact, as they had on the day of Caleb's attempted assassination. That struck him as a potentially bad omen, but he told himself he was being silly. In fact, he'd picked the site and the table deliberately. It was one of the places he used regularly for business meetings in his shipping house owner's persona, after all, and Macfrazan, whose cover was that of a purchasing agent for a Desnarian merchant house which was constantly hiring cargo vessels, had a perfectly logical, ostensible reason for meeting with him.
"All right," he said after a moment. "What's so important it couldn't wait 2 more days? "I finally got one of my people into the King's Harbor dockyard," Macfrazan said, and despite himself, Maison sat a bit straighter, eyes narrowing. "I know it's taken longer than either of us hoped it would," Macfrazan continued, "and he was only there for a few hours, but he managed to pick up at least a little information."
"And?"
"And I'm not sure what to make of it," Macfrazan admitted.
"Well, don't just sit there," Maison commanded.
"Sorry." Macfrazan gave himself a little shake and sipped from his chocolate cup.
Then he set the cup back down and leaned a bit closer to his superior.
"They've got 6 new ships under construction in the yard," he said. "Not galleys. Galleons."
Maison frowned in perplexity. What in Langhorne's name could the Royal Carisian Navy want with galleons?
"I know."
Macfrazan's small shrug was eloquent with frustration.
"It doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's what they're doing. Did your man manage to pick up any indication of why?"
"No one's talking about it very much, even in the taverns and bars," Macfrazan said. "But according to the gossip he did overhear, they're arming them with cannon. Lots of cannon.
According to one fella, he got drunk enough to risk pumping a bit. They're putting as many as 30 or even 40 guns aboard some of them.
Maison's frown deepened. That was as silly as anything he'd heard lately. Oh, it might explain why they were building galleons, since he couldn't think of any practical way to put that many guns aboard a galley. But it didn't explain why they wanted to mount that many guns in the first place. No doubt they'd be able to fire a devastating broadside before boarding, which would certainly be worthwhile. But they wouldn't have time for more than a single broadside each, and given how clumsy and unmaneuverable galleons were, closing with a galley in the first place would be all but impossible.
"Whatever they're up to," Mokfrazan continued, "they seem to think it's pretty important. My man managed to confirm the rumors about Caleb. He's taken personal charge of their efforts out there, and he's pushing hard. Seems to be doing a damn good job of it, too, I'm afraid."
"I wish I could say I was surprised by that," Maison said sourly. "Unfortunately, he's a lot like his father in that regard. Life would be so much simpler if they were both just idiots. But then the prince probably wouldn't need us here, would he?"
"Probably not," Mokfrazan agreed. "But what do you make of it?"
"I'm not at all sure either," Maison admitted. He leaned back in his chair, drumming lightly on the tabletop while he watched the hucksters in the square across the street hawking their wares. A huge, articulated, eight-wheeled freight wagon rumbled past, big enough to require two draft dragons, and one of the big, six-limbed lizards snuffled wistfully as it smelled the fresh vegetables on display.
"You're right about the importance they must attach to whatever it is they're doing, especially if that's where Caleb's disappeared to," he said finally. "And I suppose those new rigging plans Oliver has introduced could have something to do with it, too. Every report about them indicates that even the square riggers he's been experimenting with are lots more maneuverable. Maybe they actually think they can get a galleon into effective artillery range of a galley."
"I just don't see them doing it without getting swarmed," Mokfrazan objected. He wasn't rejecting Maison's theory out of hand, but clearly he wasn't convinced either.
"I could believe they thought they could get into range to smash one galley, but an entire fleet? What do they think all the other galleys are going to be doing in the meantime? And how do they expect to coordinate their own galleys with galleons?"
"I didn't say I thought they could do it," Maison shrugged. "I'm just trying to figure out what they could possibly be thinking. And," he continued a bit reluctantly, "the fact that I can't makes me very nervous. Whatever else the Carisian Navy may be, it's not exactly run by fools."
Mokfrazan nodded in emphatic agreement. Like Maison, the more Mokfrazan saw of the Royal Carisian Navy, the more he came to appreciate its quality. The Coruscantian Navy was one of the best in the world, but it wasn't in the Carisian Navy's league. No one else's navy was, and Mokfrazan had found himself sharing Maison's concern over the fact that not even Prince Hector seemed to realize just how true that was. But the immediate point, he reminded himself, was that Carisians normally didn't do stupid things where their navy was concerned.
"There were two other tidbits of information," he offered.
Maison quirked an eyebrow at him, and he shrugged.
"First, Oliver seems to think he's finally worked out a way to sheath a ship in copper without having it fall apart. At any rate, according to my man, the ships they're building are all supposed to be coppered when they're finished."
He and Maison looked at one another thoughtfully.
Sir Dustin Oliver's mania for finding some way to protect his ship's hulls from the depredations of borers was well known. Not that he was alone in that, of course. The several varieties of shellfish and worms which fell under that general heading could literally devour a ship's timbers in a matter of only a few months, and every attempt to stop them with pitch or some other form of protective coating had failed. If Oliver truly had managed to solve the problems which had so far stymied his efforts to use copper, the long-term implications would obviously be significant. But at this particular moment, Jaspar Maison was rather more concerned with short-term implications.
"You said two tidbits," he observed. What's the other one? The minor fact that they appear to have assembled a squadron of galleons to practice whatever it is they're up to, Mark Frazan said grimly. It's only 5 ships, but it seems to spend a fair amount of time out on exercises, and it anchors in the Citadel Basin, well away from any other shipping whenever it's in port. According to the fellow my man got drunk, it's commanded by a Commodore Stainer.
Stainer? Maison repeated slowly. The last name was scarcely unique in Karras, but it wasn't especially common either.
Would that be Sir Dominic Stainer?
The bishop's younger brother, Mark Frazan agreed with a nod.
Now that's interesting, Maison murmured while his brain raced. On one hand, it was reasonable enough, he supposed. If this mysterious project of theirs was important enough for Caleb to take personal command of it, then they'd want one of their best naval officers working with him on it. And everything he'd ever heard about Commodore Stainer suggested the Commodore certainly fell into that category. But there was also the connection to Telesburg's bishop. Rumor had it that Bishop Executor Gerald had been known to express more than a few qualms about Stainer's ultimate loyalties. If his younger brother was this deeply involved in whatever Harald and his son were up to, then Bishop Michael probably knew all about it too. Which meant the church, or at least the Carisian branch of the church, also knew about it. Although that didn't necessarily mean the bishop executor did.
I wonder, Mark Frazan said. His thoughtful tone drew Maison's attention back to him, and the younger man shrugged.
I was just wondering, he continued once he was certain he had his superior's ear, about those galleons Oliver is building right here in Telesburg.
What about them?
Well, it just occurred to me while we were sitting here that he has a dozen of them under construction for 8 different owners. That's in addition to all these schooners of his, of course.
Every shipyard in the kingdom's laying down ships right and left, Maison pointed out dryly. The yards that aren't actually building are all busy re-rigging existing ships to take advantage of the new sail plans. And it's all Oliver's fault, one way or another.
Well, his and Hausman's.
I know, but apparently all these new galleons of his are identical to one another, and according to a couple of carpenters working in Hausman's Telesburg yard, there are some significant changes in their design. For one thing, they're a good 20 or 30 feet longer, and a hell of a lot more heavily built than any galleon those carpenters have ever worked on before. I know Oliver's reputation, and I know these new rigging notions of his have only strengthened that reputation. Still, doesn't it strike you as a bit odd that 8 different shipowners should simultaneously order 12 new ships, all built to a new and untested design?
That does sound a bit peculiar, Maison acknowledged. He sipped chocolate thoughtfully, gazing out at the busy street scene once more.
You'd think they'd be a little bit more conservative, wouldn't you? He mused aloud.
Maybe let Oliver build a couple of these new designs of his, get them into service and see how they actually performed, before they sank that much money into them.
That's exactly what I was thinking, Mark Frazan agreed. At the same time, as you just pointed out, he has stood the entire Carisian shipbuilding business on its ear. At the moment, people are so busy throwing money at him if he'll just design a ship for them that these people may have simply decided that if they want an Oliver-designed ship at all, they'll have to take what they can get. And, the younger spy admitted, they've already seen plenty of evidence that his new ideas about rigging work pretty much as advertised.
That's all true enough, but I think the possibility that he's actually building them for the Navy needs to be considered seriously. Maison said. And if that's true, we'd better report that possibility to the Prince while we work on either confirming it or denying it.
He sat for a moment longer, contemplating the news, then shrugged.
It may not make a lot of sense to us right this minute, but at least we know a bit more than we did.
Good work, James. I'll get a dispatch off to Manchir with Captain Waite tomorrow morning.
With Captain Waite tomorrow morning.
Merlin Athrawes frowned as Owl played back the day's take from the bug assigned to follow Jaspar Maison around. The endless hours he was investing in what he'd come to think of as Project Bootstrap left him far less time than he would have preferred to deal with things like monitoring Maison's whereabouts. He'd had to leave virtually all of that sort of activity up to Owl, and that made him nervous. To be fair, the AI seemed to be handling the task adequately so far. It was Owl who identified Machverzon as Mulvane's replacement, and the computer did an excellent job of keeping anyone in its sights after Merlin had tagged that individual for surveillance. But Owl remained hopelessly literal-minded and unimaginative, and Merlin had no choice but to allow the AI to sort and analyze the take from the majority of the snarks and hope nothing critical got lost. Some of the snarks Merlin continued to monitor personally, those watching Hector, Narman, and Archbishop Erake, for example, but even there he was forced to rely on Owl's recognition of critical keywords to direct his attention to relative bits of information. Merlin leaned back in his chair in his darkened quarters while he pondered. The fact that he could get along with so little sleep helped some, at least, although he had to remember to disarrange his bedding every night. "Should I take this information to Wave Thunder?" he mused. It had to happen sooner or later, and at least they don't seem to have picked up on the changes in the artillery itself. But just what they already know is going to start someone like Hector asking questions I'd really prefer not get asked just yet. If he told Wave Thunder about this particular vision, the Baron might just feel inclined to pick up Machverzon and all of his identified agents. In many respects, Merlin wouldn't have minded shutting down Hector's network again. But if they did that, Hector was going to wonder just what had inspired them to do so. And if they didn't shut down his entire network, then the information Machverzon had already picked up would probably get through to Coruscant anyway, which would almost certainly start Hector's agile mind down the same path. Of course, there is another possibility, he thought more grimly. Nothing says Captain Waite has to survive to get Maison's dispatches to Hector. Given the voyage time between Telesburg and Monshear, Sea Cloud's failure to arrive on schedule would probably throw at least some serious delay into Hector's information loop. The transit time was almost 40 days either way for the disguised courier. If she should suffer a mischief, it would be 80 days at the earliest before Maison learned of her loss, and then it would take his replacement dispatch another 40 days or so to reach Hector. It was tempting. In fact, it was very tempting, and the recon skimmer could eliminate Sea Cloud almost effortlessly. Doing so would require the deaths of Waite and his entire crew, of course. That thought was enough to make Merlin hesitate, but it wasn't as if they were exactly innocent bystanders. Every one of them was a member of the League Navy, and arguably all of them were spies as well. Which, Merlin admitted to himself, was really largely beside the point, except for his own desire to justify the action he was contemplating. He replayed the entire conversation between Machverzon and Maison one more time, then shrugged. Destroying Sea Cloud wouldn't really do that much for us, he decided. Maison's obviously going to be sending follow-up dispatches as he and Machverzon turn up additional information anyway. So taking out Sea Cloud would only delay things a bit, unless I'm prepared to start picking off every courier Maison and Hector send back and forth. He grimaced distastefully at the thought and shook his head. No. I need to discuss this vision with Wave Thunder and Harald. They've still got a lot better ear than I do for how Hector's likely to respond. Besides, it's not going to be all that much longer before Erake gets here for his pastoral visit. That's going to cause more problems than letting this snippet of information get through to Hector ever could. And this way, he admitted to himself, at least I won't have to feel like I'm shooting fish in a barrel. He stopped shaking his head and nodded, satisfied with his conclusion, and turned his attention to the Snark which kept tabs on Prince Norman.
July, Year of God, 891. 1. Royal Palace, Trangir, Kingdom of Taro.
"Good morning, Your Majesty," Father Joshua MacGregor murmured, bowing deeply as the Chamberlain ushered him into the private audience chamber.
"And to you, Father,"
King Gorja of Taro replied. Gorja was a slender man, especially compared to MacGregor's solid, broad-shouldered bulk. He was also barely into his mid-30s, with dark hair and a complexion substantially darker than MacGregor's, and he was dressed in loose robes of silk. He also wore the kerchief, the traditional bandana-like headdress of Taro, instead of the heavy three-cornered cap of the priesthood, and he looked irritatingly comfortable despite the weather. As if thoughts of the weather had summoned it, thunder rumbled once more over Thole Bay, gentle with distance and almost lost in the sound of the rain. The equatorial downpour pounded heavily outside the audience chamber's open windows, beating on the tile roof of Gorja's palace. Waterfalls spilled from the eaves and ran gurgling down the gutters, and the warm air was heavy with moisture. It was also curiously still, despite the thunderstorm, settling about MacGregor like a humid fist, and his undergarments were damp with sweat.
"Taro's no assignment for a boy born in Northland," he reflected, thinking back to his boyhood in the Republic of Sidermark's Northland province. He'd grown up fishing in the cold, deep waters of Sing Wu's passage when the ice melted enough to let him, and this wet tropical oven pressed down on him with an almost physical weight. "It's amazing to me that any of them have working minds putting up with this kind of heat. I'd think just the mold would be enough to rot their brains."
At least his summer weight cassock was made of cotton instead of the traditional wool, but that was relatively little comfort at the moment, and a part of him looked longingly at Gorja's even lighter silken robes.
"Thank you for making the time in your busy schedule for me, and for agreeing to see me privately," he said as he straightened his back once again, just a bit more quickly than most diplomats would have. Gorja was a king, whereas MacGregor was a mere upper priest. But that upper priest was here as the direct representative of God's holy church, and he looked Gorja squarely in the face. There was nothing disrespectful about it, but it was always best to make one's status clear from the outset.
"It's my pleasure to adjust my schedule in order to meet with Mother Church's representative at any time," Gorja said. He actually sounded as if he meant it, too, MacGregor noted. On the other hand, kings got a great deal of practice sounding as if they meant things. "Almost as much as those who serve as diplomats in the Chancellor's service," he thought with a small inner smile.
"That's the sort of thing any priest is happy to hear, Your Majesty."
He allowed himself an outer smile as well, but then his expression sobered.
"I'm grateful for it nonetheless, Your Majesty. Indeed, I only wish all of Safehold's princes and kings were equally mindful of their responsibilities to God and his church."
Gorja's expression seemed to freeze, and his eyes narrowed.
"Excuse me, Father," he said after the briefest of hesitations, "but what prince or king could be so lost as to forget those responsibilities?" "Mother Church and the Holy Inquisition must always be mindful of the fashion in which the duties and responsibilities and temptations of worldly power may draw a ruler away from his duty to God," MacGregor said gravely. "Not all of them are as scrupulous as you when it comes to the observation of those duties, Your Majesty."
"I find that thought distressing, Father," Gorja said slowly, "and, to be honest, a little frightening, since I must assume you're telling me this for a reason."
"Don't be concerned that anyone is displeased with your own respect for Mother Church, Your Majesty."
MacGregor's tone was reassuring, and he smiled once more, albeit a bit sadly.
Yet you're quite correct. I am here to see you because of the failings of princes. Specifically, Vicar Zamsin's grown increasingly and deeply concerned about another ruler, one whose preoccupation with worldly power and wealth has led him perilously far from the path of obedience to God and his church, and one with whom, I fear, you are closely associated. Gorgia's swarthy complexion paled ever so slightly, and a few fine beads of sweat, which had nothing to do with the morning's heat and humidity, appeared on his forehead.
"I assure you, Father, that I would never associate myself with anyone who would defy God," he shook his head emphatically. "If I believed for a moment that Prince Hec—"
"Forgive me, Your Majesty," MacGregor broke in gently. "I had no intention of implying that you, or anyone in Taro, was guilty of any such thing. Indeed, I ought to have made it clear from the beginning that you yourself are not responsible for your relationship with him. It was your father who signed the treaty of an alliance with his father."
Gorgia had opened his mouth, but he closed it again with an all but audible click. MacGregor could almost literally see the thoughts chasing one another through his brain, and waited patiently while the King of Taro worked his way through them. It didn't take very long, and Gorgia's shoulders straightened as if a weight had been removed from them. Obviously, he'd feared that MacGregor was in Trangir because the Council of Vicars had learned about his secret negotiations with Hector of Coruscant. It was far from unheard of for the Chancellor to use the Church's priestly diplomats to warn secular rulers away from alliances of which the Church disapproved. And under normal circumstances, the Temple would have been most unhappy with Hector's machinations. The combination of his obvious ambition and the skill with which he'd been manipulating the situation would have made him a substantial threat to the balance the Church sought to maintain to prevent any one secular ruler from growing too powerful. Gorgia was as well aware of that as MacGregor, just as he was also aware the Temple had, on more than one occasion, encouraged the ambition and avarice of a secular ruler as a counter to the power of someone else of whom the Council of Vicars disapproved even more strongly. So if the Chancellor's personal representative wasn't trying to warn Gorgia away from Hector,
"Father," the King said after a moment, "from what you've said, I can only assume you're referring to Harald of Carus."
"Alas, I fear I am," MacGregor replied gravely.
"I'm shocked to hear that," Gorgia said, and he rubbed his short-trimmed beard thoughtfully. "While I've always known Harald was deeply aware, let's say, of the opportunities his kingdom's wealth and naval power make available to him, I'd always believed he was equally aware of his responsibilities before God and his church. I assure you, if I'd believed for a moment that he wasn't, it would have caused me to think very seriously and critically about the treaty between Taro and Carus."
Vicar Zamsin fears that the temptation of worldly power, coupled with his no doubt genuine sense of responsibility to his dynasty, is leading Harald astray. MacGregor stressed the noun dynasty ever so slightly and watched Gorgia's eyes narrow as he recognized the implication. Odd, MacGregor thought, how well the Vicars can differentiate between someone else's responsibilities to the land he rules and those to the ambition of his dynasty. It wasn't the sort of thought a priest was supposed to think, but those who served as Mother Church's diplomats required an appreciation of the realities behind their missions. MacGregor had that appreciation, but he allowed no trace of his reflections to touch his expression as he shook his head sadly.
"We're hearing some disturbing reports out of Carus," he continued. "Obviously, there's always been some cause for concern, given Carus's distance from the temple. These latest innovations are most disquieting, however. While none of them appears to violate the prescriptions, change begets change, and it cannot be long before violations do occur."
May I ask if Mother Church intends to take action? Gorgia asked diffidently.
However concerned Mother Church may be, or may become, MacGregor replied, she must always be mindful of her responsibility to act only after careful deliberation and mature consideration. Nor must she ever forget she is governed by mortal men, and that mortal men, even those called to the Orange, are always fallible. Because of that, she hesitates to unsheathe her sword until and unless she knows beyond a shadow of a doubt that transgression has occurred. With Mother Church's enormous power, and her equally great responsibility to exercise that power judiciously and in accordance with God's will, comes an obligation to be certain beyond question that the line between darkness and light has truly been crossed before she may act. What we may fear lies in Caris's future cannot justify Mother Church in taking official action if no offense has yet been committed.
I see. Gorgia leaned back slightly on his throne, the fingers of his right hand drumming lightly on the upholstered armrest as he gazed at MacGregor.
Should I understand, then, Father, he said after a few seconds, that the reason for your visit is primarily to warn me, to alert me to the Church's concerns so that I don't follow in Harald's wake if he does cross that line? That is indeed a major portion of the reason for my visit, Your Majesty, MacGregor agreed, bowing slightly but gravely, and I don't believe the Chancellor would be upset with me if I added that other princes and rulers will be receiving similar alerts.
Gorgia's eyes flickered visibly at that, and MacGregor hid a smile of satisfaction.
I am, of course, deeply distressed to learn that a ruler and a kingdom with whom I've been so closely associated has come to cause God's shepherd such concern, the king said. Obviously, given how many years Taro and Caris have been allied, it's difficult for me to believe Harald could be so lost to his duty to God. But I thank you and Vicar Zomsen for the warning. However distressing it may be, it's far better to be forewarned. I fear it will behoove me to very seriously reconsider my relationship with Caris, in light of what you've told me. You must, of course, act as your own sense of responsibility to God and your realm requires, MacGregor said gravely. I'm merely Vicar Zomsen's messenger, and it would be inappropriate for me to urge any specific course of action upon you without instructions to that effect from the Chancellor. I will say, however, speaking strictly for myself, that I believe it would indeed be wise to review your relations with Caris and your treaty obligations most carefully.
I appreciate such wise counsel, Gorgia said with matching gravity. Please tell the Chancellor I'm most grateful for his timely warning, and that I'll be thinking very seriously about all you've told me this morning.
I feel confident nothing could please Vicar Zomsen more than to hear that, Your Majesty, MacGregor said with another bow. And now, having discharged my instructions from the Chancellor, I'll bid you farewell, and allow you to return your attention to the pressing matters from which my visit must undoubtedly have distracted you. With your permission, Your Majesty?
Of course, Father. Gorgia waved his right hand in a graceful gesture of permission. Thank you.
You're most welcome, Your Majesty, MacGregor murmured, and withdrew from the presence chamber with yet another bow.
2. The Galleon Blessed Langhorn, Markovian Sea.
Good afternoon, Your Eminence.
Good afternoon, Captain Browning.
Archbishop Eric Dinis smiled pleasantly at Ellis Browning, the captain of the Galleon Blessed Langhorn, although he didn't feel particularly pleasant. It wasn't Captain Browning's fault, nor was it the fault of the weather.
Although the Markovian Sea could be as rough and treacherous as any body of water in the world, especially in the late spring and early summer, it had been kind to them for this voyage, so far at least. The water was a deep, sparkling blue. The heavens were a crystalline vault of lighter blue, banded with billows of white cloud, and the sun shone with surprising warmth as the crisp northwest wind, just cool enough to bite, came whipping briskly in over Blessed Langhorne's starboard quarter. Unfortunately, Dennis had rather more to worry about than the current weather. He'd left Homeport on Temple Bay aboard one of Vicar Elaine's dispatch galleys almost a full month before, as soon as the ice had sufficiently melted, and made a swift transit of Sing Wu's passage. The dispatch boats carried very large crews for their size, so that they could change off rowers regularly and maintain a high rate of speed. But their shallow, lightly built hulls were poorly suited to open water, and the Archbishop had transferred to the slower but more seaworthy galleon 5 days ago, which meant he was only another 5 or 6 5-days from Telisburg.
"Another thing those idiots like Conair, who think I should spend more time in Carris, don't think about," he thought grumpily. "Making my 1 month pastoral visit uses up 4 months just in transit time. I spend half an entire year either in Telisburg or traveling back and forth between it and the temple."
At least the semaphore chain along the shore of Sing Wu's passage had let him stay in touch with the temple until he'd hit the open sea. But that was hardly the same thing as being able to attend personally to his archbishopric's business. Semaphore messages were, by their very nature, short and terse, and there was always the risk any cipher one used might be broken by someone who wished one ill. He was fairly confident he could rely upon Matteo Brown to interpret even his briefest semaphore messages correctly, and to manage his affairs as well as anyone below the ranks of the episcopate could, yet he couldn't quite feel totally comfortable about it. He'd certainly trained the upper priest carefully enough, and he had no doubts about Brown's intelligence or competence. But the council's attitude towards Carris had grown even more suspicious and hostile over the winter, and if the group of four decided it was necessary to take action against Carris, Dinis's own position in the temple hierarchy would be severely damaged, at the very least. Brown was as aware of that as anyone, which meant any of Dinis's rivals might scent an opportunity to entice his aide into betraying him. All of which helped to explain his unhappy mood, despite the stiff, invigorating breeze and fresh sea air as he leaned on his silver-headed ironwood cane.
"I trust lunch was satisfactory, Your Eminence?" Browning continued, and Dennis hid an unwilling smile. The captain seemed uncomfortable. Obviously, he'd realized Dennis was feeling less than cheerful, yet he'd had no choice but to offer at least some small talk. The captain of a temple galleon couldn't very well simply ignore an archbishop who arrived on his poop deck for a post-luncheon constitutional.
"Your cook manages surprisingly well, actually, Captain," Dennis said, taking pity on the man. "I have to confess that I'd never make a good sailor, though. I miss fresh vegetables too badly for that."
"I appreciate the compliment, Your Eminence, and I'll pass it along to the cook, with your permission. As for fresh vegetables," Browning shrugged with a smile, "I can only agree with you heartily. In fact, the first thing I do whenever I return to Port Harbor is to take my wife to one of our favorite restaurants and sit down to the biggest, freshest salad I can find."
"Please, Captain," Dennis half laughed, "don't get me started on missing fresh lettuce."
"Forgive me, Your Eminence." Browning inclined his head in a half-bow, clearly relieved by the genuine humor in the Archbishop's response. Then he straightened, and his expression was rather more serious.
"Still, Your Eminence, as boring as our diet may be at sea, at least it keeps us healthy, thank Pasquale."
He touched his heart and then his lips, and Dennis repeated the gesture.
I hate to think what my men's state would be without Pasquale's teachings."
"I certainly agree with you there, Captain,"
Dinis said with complete sincerity. The Archangel Pasquale's dietary laws were particularly ironclad for those, like men who spent 5 days on end at sea, who lacked ready access to fresh provisions. On the occasions when those laws had been inadvertently or unavoidably broken, the consequences had been ugly. Dinis recalled one instance from not too many years ago, when a Dolorin galleon had been all but dismasted by a terrible storm which had blown her far into the trackless depths of the Southern Ocean. Her surviving crew had managed to contrive a jury-rig and somehow found their way home once more, but her speed had been slowed to an agonizing crawl, and most of her provisions had been lost or ruined by the storm. By the time she'd finally managed to crawl into port on Westbreak Island, 2/3 of her crew had been dead of scurvy, for they'd been unable to keep Pasquale's laws, and, as always happened, disease had followed quickly. At least the unfortunates in her crew had still had water. They'd managed to catch some of the torrential rain in funnels made of old sails in order to refill their water tanks, and whatever might have happened to their provisions, those tanks had been intact, thank Pasquale. Dinis remembered a classroom experience from his own youth. Regardless of the order for which a churchman was destined, he was expected to be at least generally familiar with the basic teachings of the other orders. That particular day, an upper priest of the Order of Pasquale had demonstrated why Pasquale required ships to store their water in iron tanks rather than wooden casks. The casks would have been far cheaper, but one look at the slimy green algae which had turned the water in the demonstration cask into a thick, stinking semi-sludge had been more than enough to make the point to young Erake. Shipboard water might sometimes taste a little rusty, but he was perfectly prepared to put up with that. Just as he was prepared to dutifully consume his daily ration of lemon juice or eat his bean sprouts. Of course, an archbishop had rather more dietary options than a common seaman. The fresh eggs from the chicken coop on the main deck were reserved first for Dinis and his clerical staff, and then for Blessed Langhorne's officers. The petty officers and common seamen wouldn't taste eggs or chicken before they made land once more, and there were still 5 sheep in the pen beside the chicken coop as well.
"What's your best estimate for our arrival in Tellisburg, Captain?" Dinis asked after a moment.
"We're actually making better time than usual, Your Eminence," Browning said. "This time of year the wind's mostly out of the northwest, like today, which puts us on our best point of sailing. It won't be quite as favorable once we pass Hammer Island and get out into the Anvil, but it should still be more with us than against us. One of those new schooners I'd been hearing about could make the passage more quickly, I'm sure, but by the master's best reckoning, we're only about 24 days out of Tellisburg."
Dinis suppressed a grimace, his mood darkening once again at Browning's reference to the new ship type. The captain was obviously blissfully unaware of the church's reservations about Carisian innovation, or he would have watched his words much more carefully with Caris's archbishop.
"Still," Dinis reflected, "perhaps it's as well he didn't. He's a professional seaman, so maybe his reaction might provide a more realistic measure of the threat the Council sees coming out of Caris. Have you actually seen one of these schooners, did you call it, yourself, Captain?"
"Indeed I have, Your Eminence." Browning's eyes brightened, and he reached out to lay one hand on the poop deck rail.
"Mind you, I love Blessed Langhorne. She's a good, stout ship, and she's been good to me and given the temple good service. But while I know the writ teaches envy is a sin, I'm only mortal. When I saw that schooner standing so much closer into the wind than any ship I've ever sailed in could have done..."
He shook his head, smiling in memory.
"Any seaman worth his salt would love to get his hands on a vessel like that, Your Eminence," he finished simply.
Dinis nodded slowly, smiling back at the captain, even as he felt his own heart sink.
The messages which had arrived from Adamson as steadily as the weather permitted had made it increasingly clear Karis was becoming even more of a hotbed of innovation and new concepts than initial reports had suggested. Dennis's own sources in the temple and in Zion strongly suggested that accounts from other sources, like Prince Narmon and Prince Hector, were deliberately and severely exaggerated, but he couldn't simply ignore Adamson's correspondence. And if Adamson was to be believed, then the schooner which so entranced Captain Browning was only the tip of the iceberg.
"If you'll excuse me, Captain," he said courteously to Browning, "I believe I'd like to spend some time meditating while I walk off a little of that excellent luncheon your cook served us."
"Of course, Your Eminence. I'll pass the word to see to it that you aren't disturbed."
"Thank you, Captain. I appreciate that."
The captain bowed once again and withdrew, leaving the windward side of the narrow poop deck to the Archbishop. Dennis composed his expression into one of suitable gravity, adjusted the light cloak he wore over his cassock, and paced slowly up and down, with the dragging limp his broken leg had left as a permanent legacy, leaning on his cane against the roll of the ship. 24 days, Browning estimated. The next best thing to 5 whole 5 days. And who knew what was happening in Telesburg or the temple while Blessed Langhorn inched across the thousands of miles between Haven and Karis? He remembered the meeting in which he'd steered the ecclesiastical court into settling the dispute over the Hanth succession in favor of Taddeo Montale. The proposition had seemed so simple then, simply a routine matter, a decision rendered in return for a generous personal gift. But that decision loomed much larger now. Then it had been no more than one more step in the well-understood dance of temple insiders. Now it was clear to Dennis his archbishopric's future was far more fragile than he'd ever thought before, and that his own action, however innocuous and routine it had seemed at the time, had served the interests of the men who wanted to see that archbishopric's wealth and power broken forever. He thought back to his winter conversation with Vicar Zamson. The Chancellor's concern had been evident, yet the vicar's reassurances that no decision about Karis was imminent had calmed the worst of Dennis's worries. But that calm had been seriously undermined as spring crept steadily closer and the ice in Sing Wu's passage had begun to melt. And Dennis's final interview with Trenaire before his departure for Telesburg had been anything but reassuring. Not because of what the vicar had said, but because of what he hadn't said. There was no question in Dennis's mind that the Chancellor, probably the entire group of four, were taking their own steps to deal with any threat arising from Karis. But none of his sources had been able to tell him just what sort of steps they might have in mind, and Trenaire's failure to tell him anything at all about the group of four's plans took on ominous overtones. He paused for a moment, staring out to sea, eyes unseeing. Try as he might, he could think of only two things which might stave off the storm which loomed steadily closer. One was to demonstrate his own firm control by taking decisive action. If the more worrisome of the new innovations could be ruled violations of the prescriptions, or even if they could be ruled simply to approach violations, and he ordered their attestations revoked, it might convince the group of four he could control the situation without their intervention. It was by no means certain it would have that effect, but it might. Failing that, the only option he saw was to convince them their dire interpretation of events in Karis was in error. If they could be brought to the conclusion that they'd overreacted, that the reports from places like Emerald and Coruscant had in fact been grossly exaggerated, then they might well step back from taking active steps against the kingdom. At the very least, they were certainly aware of how much Karis's tithes contributed to the church's coffers every year. Surely they'd hesitate to destroy that revenue stream unless they felt they absolutely must. He hoped they would, at least,
because if the church, or even just the Council of Vicars, acting in its secular role, decided Caris must be destroyed, Caris would perish. And if Caris perished, the career of the archbishop who'd been responsible for its orthodoxy would come to a sudden, shattering stop. Eric Dinis would lose his archbishopric, the wealth it represented, and at least two-thirds of his power and prestige, and he'd suddenly discovered that, beside that, the bribe he'd pocketed from Hector was meaningless.
"How can they do this to me?" his mind demanded harshly. "For years I've been their archbishop, looked after them, protected them from the Inquisition and those on the Council who are automatically suspicious of any change. And how do they repay me? By embracing all of these damnable new notions of theirs, by walking straight into the dragon's lair and taking me with them, because they're too stupid to see what they're doing."
He gazed out over the rolling blue water of the Markovian Sea, and deep inside his heart railed at the unfairness of a world in which God permitted this to happen to him. 3. Royal Palace, City of Garath, Kingdom of Dalar.
"Now, Father Albert,"
Samuel Cochrane, the Duke of Fern, said to Albert Harris as the palace footman showed the young priest into his private office in the royal palace,
"what can I do for you today?"
"First, Your Grace, let me thank you for agreeing to see me," Harris said. "I know how busy you are as the kingdom's first counselor, and I, alas, am only an under-priest." He smiled charmingly. "Believe me, I'm only too well aware of what small fish that makes me."
"Nonsense, Father,"
Fern smiled back at him, considerably more broadly.
"You serve the Council of Vicars. Indeed, your letters of introduction are signed by the Chancellor himself. That makes you a rather larger fish than you may believe it does."
"That's kind of you at any rate, Your Grace," Harris replied. In fact, as both of them understood perfectly well, it made him a very big fish indeed. But both of them knew how the game was played, and so both of them were also aware that his junior status allowed him to be an unofficial big fish. The one difference between them was that Harris knew why that was important.
"The Chancellor's letter implied you were here to discuss some diplomatic matter, Father?" "Actually, Your Grace, it might be more accurate to say I'm here in an advisory capacity. Vicar Zomsen is rather concerned about certain developments, not here in Dolar, of course, which could have unfortunate implications for God's plan, and my instructions are to share his concerns with you."
Fern had been listening with a grave smile. That smile disappeared with Harris's last few words, and he straightened a bit abruptly in his chair.
"That sounds ominous, Father,"
the Duke said after a moment into the small silence Harris had allowed to fall, and his tone was cautious. "It's always possible the Chancellor's concerns are misplaced," Harris said with precisely metered reassurance.
"And, of course, I myself am not so experienced as he in matters such as this. It's possible my understanding of those concerns is less than perfect. I may be overreacting to what he said to me when he briefed me for this journey."
"That's always understood, of course," Fern murmured, but his sharp eyes told Harris he knew better, that he perfectly understood the diplomatic camouflage of the priest's last two sentences, even if he didn't yet know the reason for it.
"Well, having said that," Harris continued, "I'm afraid there are persistent reports of disquieting changes and initiatives coming out of Caris. At this stage, there's no concrete evidence any of the prescriptions have been violated, of course. If there were, Mother Church and the Inquisition would already have acted. However, there's a growing level of concern, let us say, that the prescriptions are being more and more closely approached."
"I see," Fern said, although it was clear to Harris he didn't, not yet at least.
Mother Church cannot take action based upon mere suspicion, the underpriest continued. That, as I know you're aware, is a fundamental principle which was established long ago. But what's binding upon Mother Church in a corporate and temporal sense, as the anointed guardian of God's plan, is less restrictive when the Church's servants discover they must act in a more secular role. Fern nodded silently, this time in genuine comprehension. In a sense, Harris said, just to make sure they truly did understand one another, I'm here not in the service of Vicar Zamsin or the Chancellor of the Council of Vicars, so much as in the service of the Knights of the Temple Lands, as they seek to discharge their responsibility for the secular administration of the Temple Lands. Of course, the Knights also sit upon the Council of Vicars, so there must be a certain commonality between their responsibilities as rulers in this world and the Church's temporal responsibility for men's souls in the next. Still, that which is binding upon Mother Church must not be lightly set aside by any of her servants, whether they act in the secular or the temporal role. I've often thought it must be extraordinarily difficult for the vicars to discharge all their heavy responsibilities, Fern observed. Obviously, as King Ranild's first counsellor, my own duties are only a shadow of those which fall upon their shoulders. Despite that, there are times when I find myself torn between conflicting obligations, and that must be far worse for someone like the Chancellor. On the one hand, he has all the responsibilities of any secular ruler, but, on the other, he must be eternally vigilant against even the suggestion of capriciousness in how he might go about meeting them because of his even graver responsibilities to God and Mother Church.
That, unfortunately, is only too true, Your Grace, Harris said with a sad little smile. And in the case of Caris, the situation is further complicated by the fact that neither Mother Church nor the Temple Lands maintains any great strength at sea. Should it happen that direct action against Caris became necessary, neither the Church nor the Temple Lands would have the means for it.
Does the Chancellor think such an eventuality is likely? Fern asked. His voice was calm. Merely thoughtful, but his eyes were very narrow, and Harris shrugged.
Again, Your Grace, you must remember my relative youth and inexperience. I may very well be reading more into the Chancellor's instructions than he intended. However, my own interpretation is that he does indeed fear such a day of direct conflict may dawn. How likely it is, I'm in no position to say, but the Chancellor will have been derelict in his duty if it happened such a terrible situation should arise, despite all his earnest prayers, if he's taken no steps to prepare against it. Hence my visit to Gorath.
Indeed? Fern cocked his head to one side. Your Grace, unlike the Temple Lands, Dolar has a powerful fleet, Harris said frankly. Moreover, without wishing to suggest that considerations of material gain could drive your kingdom's policy, Caris's maritime strength is a direct threat to Dolar's own needs and aspirations. In light of those considerations, the Chancellor has asked me to point out to you that the Temple Lands and Dolar share a natural common interest. While the Chancellor's concerns are a direct reflection of his duties as one of God's senior shepherds, he's also well aware of the fashion in which Caris's growing wealth and power menace Dolar's future. The primary reason for my mission here is to alert you to his growing disquiet and to assure you that he and Mother Church understand any reservations you and King Ranild may feel about Caris. Duke Fern's eyes were very narrow indeed now.
And is the Chancellor preparing to take action if it should become necessary? He asked.
As I say, Your Grace, he has no naval forces at his command, or rather, no naval forces sufficient for a threat such as this.
nor is there likely to be time for the Temple Lands to increase their naval strength to that point. However, Harris looked Fern directly in the eye, the Temple Lands treasury is deep. Should it become necessary to take action, I feel confident the Chancellor and the Grand Vicar would recognize Mother Church's responsibility to support the sword arm of any prince or king acting in defense of God's plan. There was silence in the chamber for several seconds, and then Fern nodded slowly.
I thank you for bringing this matter to my attention, Father. I assure you I'll inform His Majesty as promptly as possible about the Chancellor's concerns, and also about your own analysis of the constraints under which he must address them. While I certainly can't speak for the King at this time, I'm sure he'd want me to ask you to inform the Chancellor that, as a loyal son of Mother Church, he stands, as always, ready to defend her against any threat.
Your Grace, I see your reputation for graciousness and piety is well deserved. Harris bowed again. I'll relay your words directly to the Chancellor, and of course, he looked up and met the Duke's eye once again, I'll keep you informed of any new messages I receive from him.
August, Year of God, 891. 1. The Archbishop's Palace, Telesburg.
Your Eminence. Bishop Executor Gerald Adamson bowed to kiss Archbishop Eric Dennis's ring as the Archbishop was shown into the Archbishop's Palace. Although the palace was officially Dennis's residence, it was Adamson's home, and the Bishop Executor always felt just a bit odd when the Archbishop arrived. As always, he'd met Dennis in the entry hall, whose black and white marble square stretched away, glistening in the sunlight pouring through the wide, deep-set windows.
"Welcome to Telesburg," he continued, straightening from his bow.
"Thank you, Gerald,"
Dennis responded with a somewhat tart smile. "I appreciate the welcome, although, to be frank, I'd rather be in Zion."
"That's understandable, Your Eminence."
Adamson returned his superior smile, but inwardly he was somewhat shocked by Dennis's appearance. It wasn't the ironwood cane and the hip-shot stance, obviously designed to relieve pressure on the Archbishop's right leg. Those he'd expected, more or less, following the dispatches about Dennis's injuries. What he hadn't expected was the semi-permanent vertical furrow between the Archbishop's eyes, or, for that matter, the worry in those eyes themselves.
"We have much to discuss," Dennis said, then glanced over his shoulder as the rest of his party filed respectfully into the entrance hall behind him.
Adamson recognized most of them, but there were a few new faces. There always were. He was a bit surprised by Matteo Braun's absence, but only for a moment. Braun's steady climb into the Archbishop's service and confidence made him the logical choice to be left home to see to Dennis's interests in the temple in his absence, and Adamson cocked his head with a slightly inquisitive expression as Dennis waved one of the new faces, a young underpriest, forward.
"Gerald, this is Father Simon Schumacher, my new secretary. Simon, Bishop Gerald."
"An honor, Your Eminence," Schumacher murmured, bending to kiss Adamson's ring.
"Welcome to Telesburg," Adamson responded.
Schumacher was a personable-looking young man, in the habit of the Order of Langhorn, with the white crown of a prelate's secretary on his sleeve. His eyes were bright and alert, and after his introduction, he stepped back into precisely the right position, one pace behind and to the left of his patron. On first impression, at least, he seemed a more than adequate replacement for Braun.
"I'm sure that after the fatigue of your long journey, you need an opportunity to rest and refresh yourself, Your Eminence,"
the Bishop Executor said, turning back to Dennis.
"I certainly do," the Archbishop agreed. "At the same time, thanks to my accident, I've been absent from Caris for much too long."
He gave Adamson a sharp, straight look.
"I'd like to get right to work, make up some of that lost time. I thought we might take time for a fairly leisurely lunch, then begin immediately with a general overview of the Archbishopric's affairs."
"Of course, Your Eminence," Adamson replied, not really surprised, given the anxiety in the Archbishop's eyes and body language. He gestured to a liveried servant.
"Howard will escort you to your chamber so that you can refresh yourself before lunch. We'll get the rest of your people settled in as well."
"Thank you, Gerald," Dennis said with a genuinely grateful smile. "That sounds excellent."
So, while I'm not totally easy in my own mind over this recent spate of new ideas, Father Pater assures me there's absolutely no evidence of a violation of the prescriptions.
"I gathered as much from your dispatches, and, of course, from young Wilson's reports," Dennis said.
He leaned back in the comfortable chair behind the desk in the large office permanently reserved for his exclusive use on his visits to his archbishopric. Adamson sat in a facing chair, and Father Simon sat at a smaller desk to one side, the nib of his pen scratching as he took notes.
"As you, I'm more than a little uneasy over the abruptness with which all these innovations have emerged," the Archbishop continued. "That's why I requested Father Pater to revisit his original evaluations of them."
He paused, then grimaced and glanced at his secretary.
"I think we'll go off record for a moment, Simon," he said.
"Of course, Your Eminence," Schumacher murmured, laying down his pen and folding his hands on his desk.
"To be totally candid, Gerald," Dennis said then, "I'm not the only person in the Temple or in Zion who's been anxious about reports coming out of Caris. The Chancellor himself has expressed his concerns on more than one occasion."
He paused, and Adamson nodded very slightly. There was no need for the Archbishop to explain that if Vicar Zomson had expressed an opinion, it was actually that of the group of four.
"My impression is that those concerns encompass more than simply these new ship designs, or the new spinning and weaving machines, or new ways of counting," Dennis continued after a moment. "Nonetheless, all those things are symptomatic of what appears to be worrying him, so I very much hope it will be possible to put his mind at ease over these matters. We need to reassure him that we're aware of our responsibilities, both to the Council and to God, and that we're meeting them with vigilance and forethought. And we also need to demonstrate that we're determined to keep an open mind, to continue to test and to withdraw the certification of suspect devices or processes if we subsequently determine that the original attestation was in error." "I understand, Your Eminence," Adamson assured him. "Good. In that regard, I'd like you to arrange a personal interview for me with Father Pater as early as possible tomorrow morning."
"Of course, Your Eminence."
"Thank you."
The Archbishop nodded to Schumacher, who picked up his pen once again, then looked back at Adamson.
"And now, Gerald, please continue."
"Of course, Your Eminence."
Adamson cleared his throat.
"I have been a little concerned over a few minor points of doctrinal interpretation on the part of some of our local priesthood," he said carefully. "While I've seen no signs of any deliberate or intentional challenge to orthodoxy, there are some points upon which I think it might be well for you to counsel our priests and bishops, Your Eminence."
Dennis's eyes narrowed slightly, and Adamson continued in a deliberately unhurried voice, "Such minor matters of correction are far from uncommon, of course, and I've dealt with them as they arose. Nonetheless, while you're here in Caris, I feel it would be most appreciated by all of our priesthood to hear a frank expression of your own views and to receive your pastoral instruction."
"I'm sure you're right," Dennis agreed after a moment. "Please see to working that into our schedule. And perhaps it would be well for me to meet privately with Bishop Michael first?"
"I think that might be wise, Your Eminence, as well as courteous," Adamson said with a nod.
"See to that as well, then, too."
"Of course, Your Eminence." Adamson cleared his throat once more. "One of the brighter spots has been the readiness with which the Archbishopric's tithes have come forward," he said much more cheerfully. "That's not to say there hasn't been a certain degree of grumbling. There always is, and pleas for extenuating circumstances. I've granted a few commutations, subject to your approval, of course. The church's estates and manors, and not to mention the monasteries and convents, are generally in good order. I'm a little concerned about the management of one or two of our manors in Margaret's Land, but overall I have few complaints or criticisms. In the case of..."
"Your Eminence?" Father Pater Wilson crossed Archbishop Erake's large, luxuriously furnished office with quick, brisk strides. He went to one knee before the Archbishop and bent his head to kiss Dennis's ring, then remained kneeling until Dennis touched him lightly on the shoulder.
"Rise, Father," the Archbishop said, and Wilson obeyed.
He folded his arms in the sleeves of his cassock, waiting silently, his expression both attentive and respectful, and Dennis studied him thoughtfully. He had the Wilson look, the Archbishop thought. That strong nose and the stubborn, one might almost say mulish, set of the mouth were all too familiar, but there was something else about this youngster. Something in the gray eyes, or perhaps the set of the shoulders. It wasn't defiant or disrespectful. Indeed, it was almost serene. Whatever it was, it made Dennis uneasy, and he smiled a bit more broadly than usual to conceal it.
"I appreciate the promptness with which you responded to my request for a re-examination of your conclusions concerning the new processes and devices introduced here in Caris over the past year or so, Father.
I'm gratified that I was able to meet your requirements, Your Eminence."
"Yes. Well..."
Dennis turned and limped around behind his desk and sank into the comfortable chair.
"While I appreciate how quickly you responded, it occurred to me that it was possible I might have rushed you just a bit. Do you feel confident that you were able to take sufficient time to be certain in your own mind of your conclusions?"
He met the young upper priest's eyes steadily. Any cleric of Wilson's seniority in the temple or Zion would almost certainly have taken the hint. Wilson only looked back calmly and nodded.
"Yes, Your Eminence, I am, thank you." "So you remain of your original opinion that there are no violations involved? No need for the church to issue any cautionary notices? Revoke any attestations?"
Dennis asked pleasantly.
"Yes, Your Eminence, I do."
"I see." Dennis continued to gaze at the red-haired young intendant with a pronounced sense of frustration. Wilson couldn't possibly be as blind to the church's political realities as he chose to appear, but his serenity was a shield, impervious to the Archbishop's prods. The group of four wanted proof Dennis was doing something, and that Carus was sufficiently obedient to its archbishop that they need not take action. And if he ordered the revocation of an attestation and Carus accepted it, which he was certain the kingdom would, he would have convincing evidence the situation was under control. But if Wilson gave him no opening, there was no way he could act. With another intendant, Dinis might have been tempted to order him to rewrite his initial evaluations to give him what he needed. With this intendant, that was out of the question. Besides, when it came right down to it, Dinis wasn't truly certain he really wanted Wilson to disallow any of the Carisian innovations.
"Or I think I'm not, anyway," he told himself. "Of course, that might be no more than putting the best face on it, since the stubborn little bastard isn't going to give an inch. On the other hand, as long as Wilson stands firm, which he obviously intends to do, even Clinton's going to find it hard to move against Carus for heresy. And if I emphasize his confidence in my 'everything's all right down here' really reports to the temple, in that case, I suppose there's nothing more to be said on that head," he resumed aloud after a moment. "However, I would like to ask you for your personal impression of this Merlin Athrawes. I read your dispatch, of course, but I found the written word frequently fails to convey all of the nuances."
"Of course, Your Eminence," Wilson said when Dinis paused with one eyebrow arched. "As I wrote in the dispatch to which you just referred, I personally interviewed Lieutenant Athrawes. Although you hadn't specifically requested me to, I felt the stories flying about required a closer look. Of course, all manner of wild rumors about him were undoubtedly inevitable, given the part he played in saving the Crown Prince's life, and then again, in that matter of the Duke of Tyrion's treason. In light of those rumors, however, I specifically raised the point of whether or not he was a Sejin. He told me that he does possess at least some of the abilities attributed to the Sejin, as the result of many years of study. It was scarcely necessary for him to tell me he had the Sejin's martial arts abilities, of course, given what he's already reputed to have accomplished. But he also told me he doesn't claim that title for himself." Wilson shrugged. "My own study of the accounts concerning the Sejin as a group indicate that very few supposedly genuine Sejin have ever claimed that title for themselves. It seems to be awarded to them after the fact, based upon their accomplishments. Bearing that in mind, my own judgment is that Lieutenant Athrawes probably is a Sejin, in the sense that his skill as a warrior will cause him to be so regarded in the fullness of time."
"And this business with the children he saved from the Kraken attack?" Dinis pressed.
"My best estimate, Your Eminence, is that the children involved were understandably hysterical and grossly exaggerated what happened. It's true the authorities in King's Harbor recovered one Kraken which had been killed with a harpoon. No others were recovered, however, and according to Crown Prince Caleb, who's an experienced naval officer in his own right, and who also had by far the best view of what actually happened, the youngsters were much closer to the wharf than they believed they were. As closely as I can reconstruct what probably really happened, they were close enough for Lieutenant Athrawes to make what probably was a fairly remarkable cast with the harpoon. That would be in reasonable accordance with his previously displayed abilities as a warrior. He then dove into the water and swam to the boat, where the Kraken he'd harpooned continued to attack the children until the mortal wound it had already suffered overcame it. The lieutenant may have helped to fend off the dying creature, but I suspect he was actually most concerned with getting the children out of the water onto the overturned boat, where the wounded Kraken would be less likely to attack them. Without wishing in any way to detract from the lieutenant's undeniable courage, I believe that must constitute the probable extent of his actions. And to his additional credit, he's never claimed to have done more than that. At any rate, and making all due allowance for the fundamental truthfulness of the children involved, I sincerely doubt that even a Seijin could throw a harpoon 150 yards, swim the same distance in the twinkling of an eye, and then strangle 3 or 4 krakens with his bare hands. Indeed, I'm somewhat inclined to the opinion that there's a snowballing effect at work here. Lieutenant Athrawes initially appeared under rather dramatic circumstances, after all. With that in mind, it's not surprising the gossip of the uninformed attributes all sorts of semi-miraculous capabilities to him.
But you believe it is the gossip of the uninformed?
Probably not entirely, but in the main, yes, Your Eminence.
And his purpose here?
Dennis asked, eyes narrowing very slightly.
I believe his purpose here is to offer his services as a warrior, an extraordinary one perhaps, but still a warrior, to the House of Armagh.
I believe he genuinely admires King Harald, and it's readily apparent that he's deeply attached to young Caleb.
You have no evidence of anything deeper than that?
Dennis pressed.
None, Your Eminence, Wilson said firmly.
I realize there have probably been reports and rumors, some of which may have reached clear to the temple, of some malevolent purpose on his part. Given the obvious trust he's won from Harald and Caleb, jealousy and spite would certainly have produced those rumors, whether there was any foundation to them or not. And to be realistic, it's unlikely Lieutenant Athrawes is a complete stranger to ambition. He's certainly in an excellent position to rise quite high in the Royal Guard, for example, and I doubt he'd refuse promotion or wealth if they were offered to him. On the basis of my own conversations with the man, and with King Harald and Crown Prince Caleb, though, I feel quite confident he has no more malign purpose than that. Indeed, my considered opinion is that this man has a profound respect for God and would never dream of defying God's will.
Dennis blinked. He couldn't help it. There was a note of absolute certitude in Wilson's voice, as if God himself had whispered in the underpriest's ear. He might be wrong, but there was no way Dennis was going to shake his belief in this Lieutenant Athrawes's worthiness.
And, truth to tell, the Archbishop thought wryly, if a Wilson is prepared to vouch for the man, who are we mere fallible mortals to question that vote of confidence?
I see, he said again, after a moment.
Well, Father, I must say you've put my mind at ease on several points this morning. I appreciate that, just as I appreciate your devotion and zeal in attending to these matters.
I'm very happy to hear that, Your Eminence, and I hope that if there's any other way in which I can be of service to you during your pastoral visit, you'll call upon me.
Of course, Father.
Dennis rose, extending his right hand across his desk, and Wilson bent to kiss the episcopal ring once more.
Go with my blessing, Father.
Thank you, Your Eminence, Wilson said.
Dennis reseated himself as the underpriest withdrew, closing the door quietly behind him. The Archbishop sat gazing at that door for a few seconds, then turned to Father Simon at his own desk.
Well, Simon, what's next on the morning's agenda?
This is a really excellent brandy, Gerald,
Archbishop Erake commented, inhaling deeply as he passed the deep, tulip-shaped glass under his nose.
Yes, it is, Adamson agreed. It was a gift from the Prior of St. Trevor's.
He smiled slightly.
I didn't ask the Prior where it came from. Probably just as well,
Dennis agreed with a chuckle and glanced over his shoulder.
I think you've put in enough hard work today, Simon, he told his secretary. Put down your pen and pour yourself a glass.
"If you're certain, Your Eminence, I don't mind taking a few more notes," Schumacher said.
"Nonsense," Dinis shook his head. "You may be willing to continue making notes, but I've put in a long, hard day. I don't intend to discuss anything else on the record tonight."
"Of course, Your Eminence." The secretary carefully cleaned his pen and put it away, then capped his inkwell and straightened his papers with equal care before closing the cover on his own desk. Then he crossed to the side table and poured himself a glass of brandy, as instructed. The sun had almost disappeared beyond the western horizon outside the windows of Dennis's office. The archbishop had been in Telesburg for 18 days now, and they truly had been arduous ones. Adamson was forced to concede that Dennis had applied himself to the many problems facing him with a degree of energy and intensity the bishop executor had never seen out of him before.
"I must say," the archbishop said after a moment, propping his feet on an embroidered ottoman, "that I feel considerably relieved on several fronts, which isn't to say," he shot Adamson a sharp look, "that I'm not still a little anxious about others."
"Isn't it always that way, Your Eminence?" The bishop executor allowed himself a small, weary smile.
"Yes, yes it is," Dennis sighed.
For just an instant his face looked years older, worn with worry as well as the fatigue of the pace he'd set himself over the past 3.5 5 days. Adamson, to his own surprise, felt a twinge of sympathy, which actually had nothing at all, or very little at least, to do with his own position and ambitions.
"I've drafted my preliminary report," Dennis continued after another sip of brandy. "I'd appreciate it if you'd glance over it in the morning. Give me the benefit of your own perspective."
"Of course, Your Eminence." Adamson managed to keep any surprise out of his voice, but the request was unusual, to say the least.
"Of course, it's probably not that surprising, given how carefully he has to have written it," the bishop executor thought after a moment, "and at least he's not asking me to co-sign it."
He felt a brief flicker of something almost like shame. Whatever else might be true, at least a large part of Dennis's potential problems were none of his making. He'd never asked for this sudden, unsavory rush of inventiveness. At least he could say honestly that his intendant had no qualms at all about all of the new devices and ideas. That should help quite a lot, in Adamson's opinion. Perhaps it wouldn't suit the more vengeful members of the Office of the Inquisition as much as making a few sharp examples would have, but it should at least pour a little water on that particular fire. As for the other, more fundamental problems of the archbishopric, those had begun before Dennis ever assumed office. Perhaps he should have dealt with them sooner, but that was a case of being wise after the fact, Adamson thought. For that matter, he himself clearly hadn't been sufficiently proactive in dealing with Bishop Michael, not that he intended to admit it to anyone. Adamson hadn't taken part in Stainer's private meeting with Dennis. Only Father Simon had been present for that in his role as the Archbishop's secretary. The bishop executor's impression was that it might have gone better, but at least Stainer couldn't have offered any open defiance. If he had, Dennis would have had no option but to discipline him, which, thank God, he hadn't. The last thing anyone needed was for the group of four to add concerns over the doctrinal reliability of the local priesthood to the pot, and if the kingdom's senior bishop had to be disciplined. But they'd managed to avoid that, at least, and if the group of four's current worries could just be allayed, even temporarily, they might manage to save the situation after all. The archbishopric only needed a little time, a year or two perhaps, without the group of four intervening to make the situation still worse, to put its house in order. That was all they really needed, he thought,
and found himself wondering just how the Archbishop had dealt with his own concerns about Bishop Michael.
"Well, I suppose I'll find out tomorrow, won't I?" he told himself, and lifted his own brandy glass appreciatively.
2. Kings Harbor, Helen Island.
"How does Dominic feel about Captain Mailer?" Merlin asked. He and Caleb sat at a table under an awning atop the Citadel, enjoying a brisk afternoon breeze as they gnawed on spider crab legs. Galvin Dakin, Caleb's valet, had a particularly tasty recipe for them, and Merlin had found he was genuinely fond of the local delicacy, although he didn't think he could have matched Caleb's prodigious, barely post-adolescent appetite for them, even if he'd had a full-sized flesh-and-blood stomach to pack them into. Now the Crown Prince took time to swallow and wash the swallow down with a long draught of beer before he responded. "I think he's reasonably satisfied," he said then, and shrugged. "Mailer's only had a couple of 5 days to settle in, after all."
"But Dominic has a point about how long we've got to let people settle in," Merlin pointed out in his best devil's advocate manner, and Caleb's teeth flashed in a smile.
"Yes, he does," he agreed. "And no, I'm not prepared to override him on a whim. But I think we can give Mailer another day or so before I order him fed to the Krakens."
Merlin chuckled, although mention of feeding anyone to the Krakens didn't really strike him as the most humorous possible joke. "Time really is getting short, I'm afraid," he said after a moment, and Caleb nodded soberly, his own mood darkening.
"You haven't had any more visions of Gorgia or Ronald?" he asked.
"Not of their having any more conversations with representatives of the Council of Vicars," Merlin shook his head. "But Gorgia's been spending a lot more time chatting up Hector's ambassador, and Ronald's had Admiral Gardner very quietly getting his navy ready to move if it has to."
"None of which is really much of a surprise," Caleb pointed out, in a voice which sounded much less concerned than Merlin knew he actually was.
"Perhaps not, but the fact that the Council's involved at all is hardly what I'd call good news, Caleb."
"Agreed.
Agreed. But you heard what Regis had to say right here on this very roof."
Caleb's expression was much grimmer for a moment.
"Sooner or later, the members of the Council who fear us would have come out of the shadows anyway. At least now, thanks to you, we know they're doing it."
"Thanks to me in more ways than you know, Caleb," Merlin thought with a spasm of guilt, then shook himself.
"I don't like the odds if they do bring Dolar in," he said frankly. "I can't say I'd care for them a lot myself," Caleb conceded. "Still, even adding Dolar and Taro to the balance sheet, Hector wouldn't have much better than a 3-2 advantage in hulls."
Merlin gave him a skeptical look, and the Crown Prince snorted. In fact, as Caleb knew perfectly well, the official strength of the Royal Carisian Navy, when fully mobilized, was 130 galleys, including the 50 in the reserve fleet. Hector of Coruscant had an active duty strength of 50 with another 30 in reserve. Narmon of Emerald had 45 in permanent commission and another 25 or 30 in reserve. That gave the two of them a combined active duty strength of 95 with another 60 or so in reserve, or a total of 150, although almost all of them were individually smaller and less powerful than their Carisian counterparts. Taro's fleet was smaller, with only 30 galleys in permanent commission and no reserve worth mentioning. But the Doloran Navy had 60 in permanent commission and another 70 in reserve, and their galleys were big, powerful ships, although they were very definitely designed as a coastal force, not for the high seas. So if Taro and Dolar were added to the ranks of Karis's enemies, King Harald's 130 galleys could find themselves opposed by well over 300.
"All right,"
Caleb said after a moment. I'll grant you that if they got every hulk in their reserve fleet into commission, they'd have us by better than 2-1. But, first, it's unlikely they will manage to get all of them into commission. And second, Dolar is over 7,000 miles from here as the Wyvern flies, and over 23,000 as the ship sails. That's a shun way of a voyage for a batch of coastal galleons, Merlin. And Kharis, and our entire navy, is squarely between Dolar and Coruscant. They'd have to get past us before they could combine.
Which doesn't mean they won't try, Merlin pointed out.
No, but if they don't coordinate things carefully, we'd be able to smash each wing of their strategy separately. And even using the church's semaphore, it's going to take time for any operation that complex to be coordinated. You were there when I discussed it with Father and Regis.
Caleb shrugged.
I agree with them. It's already early August. We're into midwinter down here, and by the time Erech's report gets back to the temple, it's going to be the end of the month or even September. That means they're going to be heading into fall up north. It takes over a month for even the semaphore system to get a message from the temple to Manchir, and from your visions, they haven't even spoken to Hector yet. So let's say they spend a 5-day or two thinking things over, then send a message to Hector. That means it's going to be somewhere around the middle of November by the time they can hear back from him. And that means it's going to be the end of February by the time they can get a second message to him. So, the earliest they should be able to move is going to be very late February or March, which is the middle of winter in Dolar. Then it's going to take at least 70 days or so for the Dolaran Navy to get any of its ships as far as Kharis. So if they get underway by the middle of March, they'll get here sometime in May, which is the middle of fall again, and only an idiot would fight a sea war in these waters in the middle of storm season. He shrugged again. If I were running the temple, I'd accept that I was going to have to wait at least another 2 or 3 months, which would mean the earliest we'd see them down here would be sometime in the spring, say October of next year.
That all sounds perfectly reasonable and reassuring, Merlin said. The only thing that bothers me about it is that it requires the other side to be smart enough to see the same objections we see.
Granted. Caleb reached for another spider crab leg and waved it at Merlin. At the same time, they don't know about Dominic and his little surprise.
No, Merlin agreed. At least, not so far as I can tell.
Well, there you are. Caleb shrugged again and cracked the spider crab leg to get at the succulent inner meat.
And how many galleons do we have? Merlin asked.
Not as many as I'd like, Caleb agreed rather indistinctly, then swallowed.
Not as many as I'd like, he repeated more clearly, but if they'll hold off until spring, that will change.
It was Merlin's turn to nod. Commodore Stainair, except it was going to be Admiral Stainair very soon now, had his squadron of galleons up to 15, 6 of them converted merchant ships armed solely with carronades. By November, that number would have just about doubled, although many of the additional ships would be just starting their working up exercises at that point. And by next March, the total should be up to almost 50, many of which, especially the purpose-built units, would carry many more guns than the original experimental squadron's units. In addition, Harald and High Admiral Seamount had already earmarked almost a dozen largest schooners building in Telesburg for impressment into naval service. Unfortunately, it was far from certain they'd be able to effectively arm all their new units as soon as they were built. Hausmann was working not so minor miracles as the vastly expanded King's Harbor foundry and his new foundry at Delphac would be pouring its first run of artillery by late October, if all went well. Even so, things were going to be tight, and they'd been forced to effectively strip the entire reserve fleet of its heavy armament already, which meant that adding 15 galleons had reduced the Navy's effective strength by 50 galleys.
It also meant they were becoming increasingly strapped for competent galleon captains. Duncan Mailer was a case in point. He was an experienced naval officer who'd commanded his own ship for over 5 years, but he was a galley captain. He thought like a galley captain, and although he was in the process of becoming an enthusiastic recruit to the concept Merlin had described as peace through superior firepower, he didn't have very much experience yet in commanding a galleon. Still, he was working hard, and they'd managed to quietly recruit several merchant skippers with previous naval experience. They had plenty of experience managing galleons. It was their naval skills which had gotten rusty. At least Stainer's unyielding concentration on merciless gun drill had paid off. He'd insisted, with Caleb's strong support, on training every member of every one of his original gun crews as a fully qualified gun captain. As a result, they'd been able to provide each ship with a nucleus of trained gun captains as it commissioned, and the Royal Carisian Navy's current gunnery standards were on a totally different plane from anyone else's. "Now if we only had more guns for them to shoot with," he thought sardonically. "At least Erake seems to be trying to keep the lid on the pot," he said to Caleb after a moment. "I know," Caleb grimaced. "I'd call the man a toad if it wouldn't be an insult to all toads. Still, at the moment, his own motives are pushing him to do what we want, and Father Pater's position hasn't hurt anything. All we can do now is wait and see. But if the Council only listens to him for a couple of more months, I'm pretty sure we'll have that break until next year. At which point," the Crown Prince's smile was not a pleasant expression, "we'll have enough galleons in commission to make them very unhappy."
3. Vicar Zamsin Trinair's Suite, The Temple.
Vicar Zamsin Trinair spooned up the last bit of his dessert custard and swallowed it with a sigh of pleasure. A mouthful of water cleansed his palate, and he sat back from the table sipping his wine with a feeling of profound satisfaction. The August day had been warm. The reports from his bailiffs all indicated his manors were likely to enjoy bumper harvests, and the year's tithing was almost an entire month ahead of schedule. It had been his turn to host up the group of four's once-a-five-day working supper, and for once he'd looked forward to it without worrying that anything would affect his digestion afterward. He'd taken extra pains with this 5 days' supper, and his chef had done him proud. Everyone except Clinton had obviously reached the point of repletion, and the only flaw in his own pleasure was the reflection that next 5 day it would be Maguire's turn to feed them. And Maguire's idea of properly cooked vegetables required them to be boiled into an unappetizing pulp.
"Well," he said in his role as host, "I suppose it's time we got to business." He took another sip of wine. "Personally, I have to say I'm rather relieved by the tenor of Dinis's dispatches."
"You are you?" Clinton half grunted. He leaned forward and helped himself to one of the unclaimed rolls, spreading it liberally with butter and stuffing half of it into his mouth in a single bite.
"I have to agree with Zamsin, Jasper," Duquesne said mildly. "I know you're not particularly fond of the entire Wilson family, but according to Dinis, Father Pater went back and reconsidered his original findings very carefully. He continues to insist there's no violation of the prescriptions. To me, that strongly suggests the reports we've been getting, a lot of them from enemies of Curris, I think it should be noted, truly are exaggerated."
"I see." Clinton's response was indistinct. He swallowed the mouthful of bread, washing it down with a hefty gulp of Trinair's expensive wine, and shook his head.
"I might be willing to agree with you, Robert," he said then, "if, of course, our good Archbishop had told us the truth in his dispatches."
"What?"
Trinair sat up straighter, aware Duquesne and Maguire had done the same thing, and looked demandingly at the Grand Inquisitor.
"What do you mean, Jasper? I mean I've never trusted that little snot Wilson as far as I could spit," Clinton replied. "And I had my doubts about Dinis's reliability if it came right down to it. So, unbeknownst to our beloved Archbishop of Caris, his new secretary, Father Simon, is an agent of the Inquisition. And his report covers a few things Dinis inexplicably overlooked."
The Inquisitor's smile was ugly, his eyes bright, and Trenaire felt his stomach clench. Clinton's hatred for Caris had been bad enough before Pater Wilson was assigned as its intendant. Since then, it had grown even more virulent, but he hadn't mentioned to any of the rest of the group of four that he intended to plant one of his own agents on Dinis. Then again, his office gave him the authority to place agents and investigators anywhere he chose, any time he chose, and Trenaire suddenly found himself wondering just how many others he had scattered about, and just whom they were keeping watch on. Which was all somewhat beside the point at the moment, he supposed.
"Should we gather from what you've just said that your agent, Father Simon, was it, disagrees with Dinis's appraisal of the situation?"
he asked.
"Oh, yes, I think you could gather that," Clinton said sarcastically.
He finished the wine in his glass, picked up the bottle, and poured another glassful, then leaned back in his chair with an expression which mingled triumph, hatred, and genuine worry.
"According to Father Simon's observations and quiet investigation, Wilson's reconsideration of his original findings was limited to a single interview with Harald and Caleb, one at which, I might add, Michael Stainer was also present, having been invited by our dear Father Pater. Not only that, Archbishop Erake somehow neglected to mention to us that this same Michael Stainer has been preaching sedition from Telesburg Cathedral itself."
"That's a rather serious charge, Zaspir," Duquesne observed after a moment or two, into the sudden silence around the table.
"Stainer should never have been confirmed as the Bishop of Telesburg in the first place," Clinton half-snapped. "That position's far too important to be left in the hands of a Clarician. But," he waggled one hand, showing his teeth in a caricature of a smile, and his eyes were ugly. "That's all water under the bridge, I suppose. Except that Stainer's been preaching sermons about the fallibility of the Inquisition's judgment." "Forgive me, Jasper," Trenaire said, "but I find that a bit difficult to believe. Surely Bishop Gerald would have reported any such sermons? And whatever your opinion of young Wilson, I can't believe he would have allowed such a challenge to Mother Church's authority to pass unreported." "Oh, you can't, can you?" Clinton's laugh was as ugly as his eyes. "Well, Father Simon was able to absolutely confirm that Adamson sent for Stainer following one of his heretical sermons, and gave him a royal tongue-lashing. So obviously Dinis's bishop executor was aware of the problem, and Dinis had his own little discussion with Stainer, one Father Simon was present for. Neither Dinis nor Stainer came right out and admitted what was going on, but it was obvious Dinis was warning him to keep his mouth shut, and that Stainer wasn't what you might call penitent either. But Dinis certainly didn't report anything about his need to counsel Stainer to me. And I think you'll all agree it's significant that neither he nor Wilson has reported a word about it to us even now."
Trenaire frowned. Even allowing for Clinton's hatred for all things Carisian, he had a point. "There's another possible aspect to all of this," Maguire said after a moment, and all eyes turned to him.
"What sort of aspect, Elaine?"
Ducairn asked.
"I've received a handful of reports about the Carisian Navy," the Temple's Captain General shrugged. "Most of them are coming out of Emerald and Coruscant, so I've tended to discount them somewhat. But in light of what Jasper's just said, and particularly in light of the possibility that Wilson's been less scrupulous in the discharge of his duties than we thought, perhaps I shouldn't have been so quick to do that."
"What sort of reports?" Trenaire managed to keep his tone short of an impatient demand, but it wasn't easy.
"Apparently the Carisians have undertaken some major changes in their navy," Maguire replied.
"Details are sketchy, but they all agree that in addition to these new rigging plans of theirs, and this new cotton gin, and all of the other innovations they've introduced, they've obviously done something we don't know about where their navy is concerned. It's the only explanation for how secretive they're being, or, for that matter, for why they should suddenly be building galleons instead of galleys." There were several moments of intense silence, and then Clinton belched. The sound was startling, and Trenaire twitched in surprise.
"So," the Grand Inquisitor said, without bothering to apologize, "what do we have here? We have a bishop who's preaching sedition. We have this huge spate of changes and new techniques. We have a kingdom in the process of some sort of secret military build-up. We have a king whose family has a tradition of defiance towards Mother Church, and whose own policies have scarcely been accommodating to her just demands. We have a bishop who's preaching heresy and sedition from his own cathedral. We have an archbishop who's concealing information from us, probably just to cover his own arse, although I wouldn't be prepared to bet my soul on that. And we have a so-called intendant who hasn't reported any of this to us. What does that sound like to the rest of you?"
"Not good," Maguire grunted.
Ducairn and Trenaire said nothing, but Clinton's venomous summation had shaken them as well.
"I'm still not convinced the situation is quite that bad," Ducairn said after several seconds. "Still, I'm certainly willing to concede that I'm not as confident of that as I was a few minutes ago. Assuming all of your assumptions are correct, Jasper, what do we do about it?"
"If Stainer's truly preaching sedition, and if neither Adamson nor Dinis has reported it to us, I see no option but to summon him and them to appear before a proper tribunal," Trenaire said.
"And that young whippersnapper Wilson as well," Maguire growled, but Clinton shook his head.
"I'm not sure that's the wisest course," he said, and all three of his colleagues looked at him in disbelief. "Oh, I'm not saying they shouldn't all face the Inquisition eventually, or that they shouldn't suffer the full penalty for their actions. But if we summon Stainer to the Temple and he refuses the summons, what happens?"
"He can't refuse the summons," Ducairn protested. "The entire matter comes from under the authority of the Church's justice."
"And if Harald, who's already defied the Church's obvious desires by insisting this man be made Bishop of Tellisburg in the first place, intervenes and prevents the Church courts in Corris from remanding Stainer to the Temple?"
"Surely he's not prepared to go that far," Trenaire argued, yet he heard a certain lack of certitude in his own voice.
"He's making preparations for something," Clinton pointed out. "And don't forget how many of the clergy in Carris are native Carisians. I've argued for years that we should have assigned more non-Carisians to that pest hole, but would anyone listen? No. And now what do we have? Barely the tenth part, if that much, of the clergy is from outside Harald's kingdom. If he should choose to defy Mother Church, at least a sizable minority of those Carisians are likely to support him. And then what do we have?
A fresh, even more profound silence descended upon the dining room. It was amazing, Trenaire thought, how swiftly his own mood had gone from one of pleasant content to something very, very different. But if Clinton was correct, if his worst-case assumptions proved accurate, they would be looking at a nightmare the church had never confronted before. The armed resistance of an entire kingdom to God's will. And if that resistance prospered, or even if it simply took some time to quell, which was scarcely unlikely, given Carus's sheer physical distance from the temple and the temple lands, its example might well spread. The Chancellor shuddered at the thought of what might happen if Sidermark, for example, were to fall prey to the same madness, and if Carus were allowed to continue its military expansion, an expansion which, it now seemed, might be violating the prescriptions after all, it might well seize Emerald, Coruscant, and even Chisholm by force of arms before the Church could mobilize against it in sufficient strength. And if that happened... "So how do we avoid all of that, Jasper?" he asked finally, and Clinton shrugged. "I think the answer to that is fairly simple, really." His colleague's surprise was obvious, and he chuckled, the sound harsh, almost hungry. "Of course it is. Zamsin, you yourself started putting the pieces into place to support Hector if it proved necessary. Well, I submit that it has proven necessary. I think our simplest, safest, and best course is to go ahead and support Hector and Narmon, but as the Knights of the Temple Lands, not the Council of Vicars. Barman's in Monshire on his own pastoral visit right this minute, so tell him to speak frankly with Hector. Then bring in Dolar and Taro, and Chisholm, for that matter, but Mother Church stays out of it. The Temple Lands can support our friends, just forgiving Ronald all the interest on the loan payments he still owes the Treasury would be more than enough to buy his support, but the Church and the Inquisition will have nothing to do with it, until, of course, Harald's been defeated." "And then?" Trenaire asked, trying to ignore the queasiness stirring in the pit of his stomach. "I think we can count on Hector and Narmon to wreak sufficient havoc on Carus. If necessary, we can encourage them just a bit. But by the time Telesburg and most of their other major towns and cities have been burned, and their precious merchant fleets been destroyed, what's left of Carus will be destitute, desperate for aid, at which point Mother Church's loving arms will reach out to her distressed children. The Treasury will pour gold into rebuilding their shattered homes, and in the process, the Office of Inquisition will be perfectly placed to purge the unreliable elements of the priesthood." He smiled with cold, vicious satisfaction. "In short, I believe we're in a position to solve the Carisian problem for generations to come, my friends."
September, Year of God, 891. 1. Royal Palace, Monshire, Coruscant. Prince Hector of Coruscant watched with carefully hidden anxiety as Boris Barman, the Archbishop of Coruscant, strode past the throne room guards and paced gravely down the runner of carpet towards his throne. The guards watched him pass with carefully expressionless faces, although the stiff set of their spines showed how little they cared for their instructions, then closed the throne room doors behind them from the other side. The ragged ends of a late winter thunderstorm had cleared earlier in the day, and sunlight through the stained-glass windows threw flowing patterns across the floor. The gems on the archbishop's formal priest's cap sparkled whenever he stepped through one of those pools of light, and his expression was solemn. Barman reached the foot of the dais and bowed his head gravely. Then he straightened, and Hector inclined his own head in a gesture of respect.
"I must admit, Your Eminence," he said, "that I was a bit startled, and more than a little apprehensive, when I received your message."
"I apologize for that, Your Highness," Barman said. "Only the most pressing circumstances would have led me to request an audience on such short notice."
"I realize that, which explains my apprehension," Hector replied, showing his teeth in a slightly tight smile, although request was a pale choice of verb. The Archbishop's message had been a none too thinly veiled peremptory demand for an immediate and completely private meeting. Had he been anyone else, Hector would have told him, none too politely, what he could do with his request. Since he was who he was, however, the prince had no choice but to comply, which explained his guardsman's unhappiness, and his own.
"The world knows that you are your own first counselor, Your Highness." Barman produced a small smile of his own. "Were you not, I would undoubtedly have made whoever served you in that capacity apprehensive instead of yourself."
"An excellent point, Your Eminence. Perhaps I should consider changing my arrangements." Barman chuckled dutifully, and Hector drew a deep breath. "Nonetheless, Your Eminence, you did request the audience, and you're here now. So, how may the League of Khorasan assist Mother Church?"
"Actually, Your Highness," Barman said slowly, "I'm not really here in Mother Church's name this morning."
Hector's eyes widened in surprise, and the Archbishop shrugged slightly.
"I am here on behalf of Chancellor Trenaire, but not in his capacity as Vicar Zamson."
Hector's widened eyes narrowed in sudden speculation as he recognized Barman's distinction. As Chancellor, Trenaire might speak officially for the Council of Vicars or for the Knights of the Temple Lands. As Vicar Zamson, he could speak only for the Church, which put an abruptly different face on Barman's request for a completely private audience.
"I see," he said after a moment. "In that case, how may the League serve the Chancellor?" "In point of fact, Your Highness, I'm here to discuss how the Chancellor can be of assistance to you."
"Indeed?" Hector kept his voice and expression alike under careful control, but it was hard.
"Your Highness," Barman said, "I've been instructed to speak very frankly, without the normal diplomatic circumlocutions. With your permission, that's precisely what I intend to do."
He raised his eyebrows, and Hector nodded.
"Thank you, Your Highness."
Barman bent his head once more, then cleared his throat.
"Your Highness, all the world knows that you and Prince Snarman have, for some years now, found yourselves increasingly at odds with Harald of Caris. Mother Church, of course, must always be grieved when those she's anointed as secular rulers view one another with enmity. Nonetheless, Chancellor Trenaire recognizes, as one charged with heavy secular responsibilities of his own in the Temple Lands, that even reasonable men may sometimes find themselves on opposite sides of irreconcilable differences. When that happens, it may result in open war. Other times, it may result in an ongoing, festering wound which poisons all about it."
The Archbishop had Hector's undivided attention. The prince made himself sit calmly in his throne, listening only attentively, but if Barman was headed where he appeared to be headed...
"Although both Khorasand and Caris are far from the Temple Lands, the fact that between your lands, and, of course, Emerald, your ships carry so much of the world's cargoes, means that any quarrel between you affects everyone who depends upon that shipping. The Knights of the Temple Lands are no different from any other rulers in that respect, and they've watched with increasing alarm as the hostility between you and Harald has deepened. Until recently, however, they've embraced a policy of neutrality in this particular dispute. That seemed the most reasonable course for them to pursue. But in recent months, the Knights of the Templelands have become aware of what they believe represents a dangerous shift in policy on Carus's part. Since the ecclesiastical courts decided against Harald's protégé, Bregard, in the matter of the Hanth succession, he appears to have resolved to settle the quarrel between you, and no doubt to avenge himself for the part he seems to feel you played in the succession dispute, by force of arms.
Hector managed not to blink. Despite his own concerns over the reports from Maison and Mokverzon, he rather doubted, as he'd told Earl Corus, that Harald had any intention of attacking Emerald or Coruscant any time soon. If nothing else, fear of the Church's possible reaction would have to hold him in check.
"Under most circumstances, I suppose," Barman continued, "any quarrel, even a war, fought this far from the Temple Lands might not appear to be of great consequence to the Knights of the Temple Lands. Given, however, Harald's obvious resentment of Mother Church's decision against him, and the fact that he's clearly contemplating a war of conquest against his neighbors, and the fact that should he succeed in defeating you and Narmin, he would acquire near dictatorial control of so much of the world's seagoing trade, they simply can't view his clear intentions with equanimity. Indeed, they believe Harald's ambition poses a clear threat to that peaceable state of relations Mother Church is charged to maintain between all lands. Mother Church herself may not, of course, take sides in a purely secular conflict, unless one side should be proven to be in violation of God's law or plan. And no one would suggest those circumstances apply at this time. But, in their capacities as rulers, the Knights of the Temple Lands would be derelict in the discharge of their responsibilities to their own lands and subjects if they allowed such aggression to prosper. Therefore, Chancellor Trinaire has charged me to inform you that the Knights of the Temple Lands have decided the time to restrain Carisian aggression has come. They are prepared to assist you and Prince Narmin against Harald's overweening ambitions.
Barman paused, and it was Hector's turn to clear his throat.
"Obviously, Your Eminence," he said, "I must welcome this evidence of the Chancellor's support. I do, I assure you. However gratifying though it is, I fear the Knights of the Temple Lands are far away, and even were they not, they possess but little naval strength."
"Of themselves, that's certainly true, Your Highness," Barman agreed. "However, you aren't the only prince to whom the Chancellor has communicated his concerns over Carus. It's become obvious to him that Carus's ultimate ambition is to secure control of all the world's maritime trade for its own selfish profit. Accordingly, the interests of other lands, beyond Coruscant and Emerald, are equally, if less immediately, threatened. In the Chancellor's view, it would be only just for those other lands to bear their fair share of the burden of defeating that ambition."
"I see." Hector could scarcely believe what he was hearing, and he cautioned himself to go slowly. This totally unanticipated offer went far beyond anything he'd ever dared allow himself to hope for, and the temptation to seize it instantly was overwhelming. But he had no idea what had prompted Trinaire to send Barman to him, nor did he see where the Chancellor's own ultimate objectives might lie. On the other hand,
"May I know which other lands the Chancellor has in mind, Your Eminence?"
"Of course, Your Highness. I'm instructed to tell you that the Chancellor has been in contact with King Ronald of Dolar. He also suggested to King Gorja of Taro that he might perhaps positively consider any initiatives your ambassador might extend. And it's also my understanding that Archbishop Jerome has been charged to deliver a message to Queen Charlian as well, urging her to support your efforts in this matter."
Despite all he could do, Hector's jaw dropped slightly. probably the only person in the entire world who hated him more than Harald of Carus did, was Charlian of Chisholm. Yet even she would be unable to defy a suggestion from Trinair to support him, which only made the Chancellor's offer even more breathtaking. An alliance of virtually every other maritime power against Carus? With the backing of the Templelands and their enormous wealth? And, whatever fiction Trinair might choose to maintain, the implicit support of the Church itself? Your Eminence, I'm stunned, he said, with total honesty. I had no idea the Chancellor was so well informed on affairs so far from the Temple Lands, nor did I realize how clearly he saw the ambitions of Carus. Obviously, if he feels this strongly about it, I would be eternally grateful for any assistance he or the Knights of the Temple Lands might be able to provide. Then should I inform the Chancellor you accept his offer? Of course you should, Your Eminence. I'm sure he'll be overjoyed to hear that, Your Highness. Barman smiled broadly. And he's instructed me to tell you, should you accept his offer of assistance, that the messengers of the temple will be at your disposal for coordinating with your new allies. Please tell him I am deeply, deeply grateful for all he's so generously offered, Hector said sincerely. I will, Barman said. And now, Your Highness, I'm sure you have a great deal to attend to, and with your permission, I'll leave you to it.